Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, welcome, welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station. And that is Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking about walking a mile in somebody else's shoes and how our nervous systems deal with trauma. Now, did I just trauma? Like it's a fun activity. Trauma! Like, whoa, okay. All right, cool. So we're talking about our nervous system and how it deals with trauma. So drum roll, please. The number in studio is 083-288-401. We're talking about ourselves. We're talking about ourselves. We're talking about our inner beings. We're talking about the complex stuff that nobody really talks about. Nobody has the energy to talk about. And nobody really wants to talk about it. Because zero interest. But if we're talking about somebody winning an award, that's great. If we're talking about somebody's new music video, that's great. If we're talking about anything else, that's great. A little bit of gossip, that's great. So, sister is eating chips. And patient is like, yeah, this is unprofessional. Me, I'm on the sister side. Me, I'm on the nurse side. Come to me if you must. Me, I'm on the nurse side. Me, I'm on the nurse side. In full no understanding, eh? No understanding of their roles. I don't even understand her uniform is her uniform for like emergency nurses. I don't understand, but I'm on her side simply because, right? She's most entitled to what? To eat, eh? To have lunch. And as long as the hospitals inside this country don't have, right? Dining halls where people can get out of your face with their lunch and go and eat, right? Then I don't think that we should be pointing fingers at people that are having their lunch in front of us. And also, just because you think it's an emergency for you does not mean it's an emergency. Because we as pacientes, we like, right, that our emergencies become everybody else's emergencies. And no, it doesn't work like that. But all in all, happy Monday. Today is the 16th of the third month. 2026 is a Monday evening and it is 6 minutes past the hour of 9. Thank you so much, Tatekauluma. That was in entertaining you guys, informing you guys and being with you guys. And here I am to take over. So we already explained, right? Because Saturday was most now another, I mean Sunday, sorry, Chomi. Sunday was most now another day where, you know, we are doing other things. Do it to me one more time. I'll give you one more chance, this heart of mine. Do it to me one more time, baby. Can't get enough of your love. I don't know why that was the song I picked. Mara, I picked it, okay, to sing it. Because I was going to sing another song. I was going to sing, I know that he loves me because he told me so. I know that he loves me because he's feeling sure. He says to me the way he's kissing me. You see how he is so deep in love. I know that he loves me because it's obvious. I know that he loves me because it's me he trusts. And he said to me, if he's not kissing me, you see how he is so deep in love. And when I start to burn, I say the way we love, the way we turn, it felt so good to find true love. And you right then and there, you were the one. Ooh, I know that he loves me cause he told me so. I know that he loves me cause his feelings show. Like men don't lie, you know. Men are nice people, guys. Men are nice people. So we're talking about your nervous system. Yesterday we were talking about the fact that we don't talk enough about how it feels like when you're completely healed. We talk about the process in which it takes for us to heal. And prior to that, we were talking about trauma. We were talking about how it feels like to be traumatized. And today we're going to be talking about our nervous system. You know, how complex trauma can actually mess up your nervous system. And how maybe, just maybe, you're not cray cray. Maybe you were just traumatized and that's why you are the way you are, and that's life, right? And you know, it's complicated like that. But all in all, Well, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of anything that we're playing over here. We are strictly using it for learning purposes because as we want to hear what Carl Jung said, as we want to hear about the effects from Tim Fletcher, and we want to keep going and keep learning and hozala, hier kom ons, hier gaan ons, daar gaan ons, die kom ons, hier kom ons, hier kom ons, hier kom ons, tot binne Jerusalem, alle nasies, jylle moet hierre din, alle nasies, jylle moet hierre din, alle nasies, jylle moet hierre din, tot binne Jerusalem. If you didn't sing with me and you know this song, ne?
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome to another Friday night. Tonight I want to look at how trauma affects our nervous system. And I'm not even going to be able to cover all of the different ways that it affects our nervous system. And again, it's all negatively. But what I want to do is give you the big picture so that you have a really good understanding of just what happens inside of us, our nervous system, when a person is going through trauma, and then the long-term ramifications after that happens. So to appreciate it, you have to understand that our nervous system, our central nervous system, basically operates all parts of our body, all of our organs. It is picking up sensations all the time from our environment and making adjustments within us in order to respond to those. So it is a key thing. It goes right down our back into all of our nerves. It is the control center. So understand then that it has two parts. So we're going to really focus on this because this is where we're going to see the effect of trauma. There's the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. So the sympathetic nervous system, it is the part of our nervous system that is all about action, activity, productivity, energy, survival. It is that what is activated by stress, by working hard, by danger. That's what kicks in. That's what gives us energy. But then we have a balancing part, the parasympathetic nervous system. So its job is to bring rest, restoration, healing. So it balances the activity, busy, productivity, work part with rest, relaxation, etc. So what you see is these need to be in balance. If you're in your sympathetic all the time and not in your parasympathetic enough, you're going to get more and more tired till you burn out, is really the key. So you have to have these two things in balance. So what happens with complex trauma is it messes all of that up big time and with many, many long-term ramifications. So just to give you an idea, what you can see on the right is your sympathetic nervous system. So when you're kind of stressed, in danger, or just very in productivity mode, it affects your pupils. Your pupils dilate so that you can absorb more light and see more. Your mouth goes dry. Many of you have gone through that. Your heartbeat increases. Your airways allow for greater air to come in. Your stomach sometimes can feel a bit nauseous. You're not hungry. That's affected. Your gallbladder is affected. Your digestion is affected and slowed down. All of that. And then you get adrenaline and sometimes your bladder doesn't work. So all of that is when your systematic nervous system is activated. And then your parasympathetic on the other side, you can see, comes in to bring relaxation, to help digestion, to enable you to sleep. All of those are very important functions. And so that is your two parts of your nervous system. So this shows you on the right A healthy way of living is you have your performance zone where you have your sympathetic nervous system happening. And then you go into your recovery zone. You relax, you rest. And then that enables you to maintain that throughout your life and be productive. But you have the right balance of output versus input self-care. Okay, let's bring in complex trauma. So complex trauma.
Cyber threats are no longer just an IT problem. They are a risk to our national security and the core of our economy. Join various leaders and industry stakeholders at the 3rd Namibia International Cybersecurity Conference and Exhibition, NICSC 2026, taking place from the 22nd to the 24th of April at Arabush Travelodge in Windhoek. Corporate early bird registrations close on the 31st of March. So register now at dstech.com.na. NICSC 2026. Securing Africa's digital future.
You're in danger all the time. The child perceives they're in danger, so that puts them into their sympathetic nervous system all the time. Or on the left, into survival. So they are in survival. The problem is that their parasympathetic nervous system can't come in to bring healing and restoration and rest, because they're still in danger. They got to be on guard. They got to be alert. And so they have to stay in survival zone and they can't rest. So what happens over time is they eventually burn out everything. And that's their only way for their body to rest. That's the only way for their parasympathetic nervous system to come in and provide healing and restoration. So that is not desirable. That has also long-term ramifications, but that is what happens in complex trauma. So let me take that further for you. So you have a child who has perceived danger. So they're neglected, they feel all alone against a big bad world, they're being abused, there's a bully at school, all kinds of racial stuff that they're going through. So there's just danger, danger, danger. So their sympathetic nervous system is going all the time. They can't relax, their body can't rejuvenate, can't heal. So what provides the energy for that sympathetic nervous system? Well, first you keep eating food, and then if you need more, you dig into fat reserves, but you also have adrenaline, because when you're in your sympathetic nervous system, especially if there's fear, danger, stress, then you get some cortisol and adrenaline happening, and we saw that last time, what happens with that. So that gives you energy for fight, flight, that gives you energy to survive, that fuels your sympathetic nervous system. What happens for some people is they find a thing called drugs, cocaine, drugs that stimulate. When that happens for people, they go, I just got more energy. I can stay awake longer. I can do all kinds of extra stuff. I got more energy. So stimulant drugs become their way of fueling their sympathetic nervous system. What they don't realize is they're just breaking down their body big time. And so as they're overusing their sympathetic nervous system, what they're going to find is it's creating emotions. When they're in that place of fear, stress, so they're going to have anxiety issues, they're going to have anger issues, they're going to feel overwhelmed and stressed regularly. All negative emotions are going to be happening as they overuse their sympathetic nervous system. That then leads to, they make impulsive decisions a lot, because they're in their limbic brain, they're just fired up with that energy, they have trouble sleeping at night, they have trouble turning their brain off, they obsess about stuff, They have difficulty being present to other people when they're in a conversation because they just got all this stuff going on in their head and all this energy. They're hypervigilant all the time. So they have very great difficulty in being healthy in relationships. They have great difficulty in coping well with life. And because they can't sleep, that's the only time their parasympathetic was able to maybe kick in a little bit. Now, it's not even kicking in for not being able to sleep. So the snowball is rolling and causing more and more tiredness, and they're heading towards burnout. So that, sadly, is what happens. But then the parasympathetic, in combat trauma, it can't be activated because the sympathetic is in survival. So, after a while, the parasympathetic nervous system kind of realizes, if I don't somehow get activated and provide some rest and healing, this person is going to burn out. So, before burnout, is there anything I can do that will help them rest? So, for many people, this is where depression comes in. The parasympathetic nervous system basically says, I am going to go to emotional exhaustion before we go to physical exhaustion. And if I go to emotional exhaustion and get depressed, at least they'll have a wee bit of rest. But here's what I want you to see. You've got the person still in danger, so their sympathetic is still operating, and they got your parasympathetic trying to kick in with depression to shut them down a little bit so they can rest. So now you got depression and what's happening in the sympathetic, anxiety. So now you've got two very paralyzing emotions that are going on inside of this person. If the person keeps in danger, in survival mode, keeps pushing themselves, the depression after a while won't even help them rest. They're going to eventually burn out or have a breakdown. And many of the people that I work with have gone through that. I've gone through that. Some of you have gone through that. It's not a good place to be. But that's what happens because of our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems being so out of balance due to complex trauma. Now let me just take this a little bit forward as to some of the long-term ramifications of this. What happens for a lot of people when they hit a breakdown, they crash, or let's say they ended up in drugs and they hit a bottom and they crash that way, they go into recovery or they go on disability due to burnout, due to all of the problems that they're having. They might have chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, other things. All of that is part of their breakdown. So they rest. And maybe it's a year they rest, maybe 6 months, maybe 2 years, but they are incapable of going back to that very productive life. So their parasympathetic is working. It's letting them rest. So they're healing a bit internally. They can get to a point where they go, okay, I'm feeling back to normal again. And so instead of going, I need to now move forward in life, balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic, what they do is go, oh, I'm feeling great again. Let's go back to sympathetic all the time, 110%, and then they burn out again. And that is, sadly, the pendulum swing that some find themselves in, where they go, 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 burnout, and burnout is basically parasympathetic, resting, feel good, let's go back 100% to sympathetic nervous system. Some that gets then diagnosed as bipolar disorder. You go from depressed to manic. Then you burn yourself out, go depressed, back and forth. And that's a very sad way for people to live. So let me take this to a person who's coming out of addiction. So they come out of addiction and they've been in treatment, they've got some sobriety under their belt, they're starting to feel good, and they go back to work. They get a job. They get in a relationship. And all they know is, let's go back to sympathetic nervous system 100% of the time. And so they go back to work, 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 go, 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 and they're starting to burn themselves out. What does their brain do? It says, I know one way to take a vacation, to get my parasympathetic nervous system working. Let's relapse. Relapse takes, then I don't have any responsibilities. Then who cares about anything? I just do my own thing. And so relapse becomes their only way of getting back to taking a vacation, but it doesn't work. It just messes them up even more. There's another thing that can happen long term, and this is really, I think, significant. What happens, I think, in the body, and there's evidence that Dr. Gavin Mate has supported, is the body begins to go, we got an issue with cortisol and adrenaline. Because this person doesn't know how to use them in short little bursts rarely. They just want it all the time. And they keep burning themselves out. So let's set up an internal system now that responds differently to cortisol and adrenaline. So now, instead of cortisol and adrenaline giving energy, let's have the opposite effect. Let's have them now make you very tired, like you've been hit by a truck, just make you exhausted. So it's almost like something switches internally that creates an allergy to cortisol and adrenaline. And many people that have burned out will testify that that's what's happened to them. So now when they get a shot of adrenaline, instead of making them feel energetic, it makes them just feel crappy and want to go to bed and sleep for a week. So all of those are just part of messing up that whole sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system. Now I want to add something that hopefully will help many of you. Because some of you go, I still don't know that I have complex trauma. Because I came from quite a good home. I didn't get really much any abuse, maybe a tiny bit of neglect, but not very much. My 12 needs were met quite well. Maybe some of my emotional needs weren't met perfectly, but it was pretty good. So I don't know why I have most of these 60 characteristics of complex trauma. So let me share a little bit about my story. And to show that my sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system got way out of whack, not because of trauma, but because of my parents' belief system and because of my basic personality. And they blended my personality with my parents' belief system, blended in not a good way to create all the symptoms of complex trauma in me. So let me explain it. There's really kind of three parts to my parents' belief system. And I think you're going to begin to see this, and I think it might apply to many of you. So my parents had this amazing work ethic. Both my parents were born during the Depression, grew up in the Depression. And so basically the whole idea of all of that was, we can't afford to buy stuff, you gotta work. You gotta make it, you gotta patch clothes up, you gotta make everything go through a second time. And so it was very much, you are always needing to work. I don't remember a time ever where my mom just sat on the couch and did nothing. If my mom was sitting, her hands were always busy. She was knitting, she was writing cards, she was doing a grocery list, like she was always doing something. And so part of what came out of that, as I grew up, was, if you're tired, don't relax because there's more work to be done. So you just dig a little bit deeper. And if you relax, you're being lazy or you're being selfish. So that was kind of the environment. It wasn't always said, it was rarely said, but it was felt by the looks you got. Or if you sat and just wanted to do nothing, here's a job. You need to be doing this. So that was all part of that. And so wasting time.
Esira shisho, pagyotari kukwathere opovoro kara wasira ya kweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Taiganjwa oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na hene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko yena cha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano gopama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo kene una okuya kwathena nukuya pa ea bidhido yiri monjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere o unji na hene unokara uishangitha tarira po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na e pangono maradura sano ododhina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you
your health, your life, your peace of mind NHP, we're about you.
Was considered to be a great evil. And you only have one life to live, so make it count. It was kind of drilled into me all the time. So what I realized looking back is that if I ever relaxed, I felt guilty. So another way to say that is, you stay in your sympathetic nervous system, that's being a good person. To go to your parasympathetic, that's being selfish, that's being lazy. And so that worked for me because I was a high energy kid. I just wanted to go all the time and I love being in my sympathetic nervous system. I love the rush of that. And so to work all the time, I had the energy to do it. And so I fell into that very easily. Then there was another piece to this, and it was a distorted view of play. So I grew up where my parents loved and encouraged us as children to play. And we did our chores, but man, we spent most of our days playing. And I played every sport I could find, that I just loved it. But once you got to be an adult, playing's for children. Now it's time to grow up. Now it's time to get serious. Now it's time to work. And so when I was in university, I was working easily 80-hour weeks. That was just, you don't play anymore, basically. It's work time now. You're an adult. So that whole concept of work, which came out of a very good work ethic, got twisted a little bit, and because of my personality, I loved it. It appealed to me. So I loved adrenaline. I loved digging deeper. I loved go, go, go. So that's the work part. But then there was a second piece, and that was love. Loving others versus loving yourself. Loving others versus self-care. So my parents were models, and in my mind, fantastic models of loving other people. I don't know many people who sacrificed more in time, money, energy to invest in other people, to care for other people, to help people, to feed people. They were constantly doing that. Their life was all about giving. That was fantastic, but there was a couple areas where I didn't quite get the full picture. So the first was this. When I was young, my parents basically operated by, If you love the way you should love, that means you don't have boundaries with people. So we could be sitting at supper, we could be having a family evening, but if the phone rang, my dad felt obligated to answer it. He didn't feel he could say, no, I'm not going to answer it because we're having family time. So they couldn't put a boundary there. If somebody knocked on the door, he didn't feel he could say, sorry, we're busy, I can't talk to you right now. He felt obligated to let them in. So love had no boundaries. So you never turn anybody away if there's a need. Then, second thing is, if you're truly a loving person, you should always be sacrificing. You should always be putting your needs aside for somebody else. That should be the constant characteristic of your life. And so because there was so much need, you just don't take time to relax and do stuff for yourself, because then that would be unloving. There's needs to be met. You got to be doing that. So if you stop then to take care of yourself, to kind of have input into your own life and do stuff you enjoy, you're being lazy or you're being selfish. You're not being loving. And what's interesting to me is my parents grew up in a conservative church culture. Much of that I'm very thankful for, but as I look back on it, here's what I realized. The people that were put kind of to a place of being emulated, this is a person that we look up to, this is a person that is valuable in our community, they were people who made the greatest sacrifices. People who loved by what I just described. What that meant was they were the most tired. They volunteered for the most things. They were always busy helping others. So what I begin to realize now with what I know is we respected people the most who were out of balance. People who went to the extreme of sympathetic nervous system going all the time and parasympathetic, no, that's probably bad. That's very interesting to me looking back, but that was considered, back then, that was considered healthy, even spiritual. Then there's a third piece, and it kind of ties in. And it's around stress. So I was given many good tools for handling stress, but I wasn't given some of the most important tools. So what are some of the most important tools for stress? You need a balance between work and rest. Well, I wasn't given that balance. Work was more important than rest, and it outweighed rest and outdid rest. Secondly, if you're going to handle stress properly, you got to learn to set good boundaries and say no to people. Well, I wasn't taught to do that. So what tool was I then given to handle increasing stress? You just dig a little deeper. Well, that appealed to me. I love digging deeper. So I went into my 20s, and I didn't say no to people. I didn't have a balance between work and rest. I just dug a little deeper. Then here's what happened. I got married. Then 2 years later, we had 3 children within 4 years. So I, all of a sudden, I had 3 children under the age of 3 or 4. So life became super busy. But when just before my first child was born, I became a pastor. And then that church started to grow and it doubled in size. And so I'm a father, a new husband, father of 3 young children and a growing church. And I'm just turning 30. And I'm working 80-hour weeks, and I'm investing in my kids, trying to be as involved as I can in their life. And all of a sudden, I'm having health issues. All of a sudden, things are starting to break down, and I burn out. All because I was unable to enforce healthy boundaries, and to have a balance between work and rest. Sympathetic, parasympathetic. Here's what I want you to see. By putting myself into that environment of marriage, children, busy job, I was actually putting myself in a complex trauma environment. I couldn't relax. I was constantly needing to be doing something on alert. I created my own complex trauma environment because I liked having my sympathetic nervous system go all the time, and I felt guilty for having my parasympathetic nervous system activated. And all of that led to a total breakdown where I had to go on disability for a couple of years. So that to me is one way then that people who come out of a very good home but get some key things not quite accurate that result in their sympathetic nervous system working more than their parasympathetic nervous system, you actually create a complex trauma environment for yourself. And then that leads to the exact same consequences in your body as if you had been raised in abuse or neglect or abandonment. Kind of scary when you think about it, because that's sadly what's happened to many people in our culture who come from decent homes, but it's that work ethic, that definition of love, that attitude, that stress, you just dig deeper, that has set people up for the exact same problems as people who come out of severe abuse and severe neglect. So let me move to how do we recover. So you're maybe going, "Ooh, you're describing me. I've lived my life in my sympathetic and then ignored my parasympathetic, felt guilty about my parasympathetic, and I burnt out, or I just got some major health issues because of it. What do I need to do?" So what I want you to see is the big picture is you're retraining yourself to have a balance between your sympathetic and your parasympathetic. But you're retraining yourself when your normal has been an imbalance. That's what feels right. That's what feels natural is an imbalance. So another way to say that is unhealthy was your normal. And unhealthy feels normal. You're trying to go to a healthy normal, but it feels not normal. And so it's going to be very difficult to retrain yourself when your default setting is out of balance. And so it's going to take you a while. That's the first thing I want you to see. And it's not going to be easy to do this, because you got your subconscious brain programming that wants to go back to your sympathetic nervous system going all the time. So here's where I think it's important for you to start. It's to understand that when you've had an unhealthy normal where your sympathetic has been going all the time and your parasympathetic has not, that was your default. That's your autopilot. You can slide back into that without even realizing it. You just get going in your day and you just don't connect the way you should with yourself to see how you're doing, and all of a sudden you're back to that old comfortable shoe of out of balance nervous system. So learn the things that trigger you to go back to that. So for many people, as soon as they start feeling stress, they go back to too much sympathetic, not enough parasympathetic, and then that snowballs. Anytime you go into a time of change or transition, all of a sudden things aren't normal. There's unknowns now. There's some fears and anxieties. That can be a trigger to go back to your sympathetic. If you have an anger or resentment that's kind of burning away inside of you, that can put you back into your sympathetic. But also, if you're feeling really good, that can put you in your sympathetic, and you just want to go and keep it going and keep feeling good, and you start to neglect your parasympathetic. So it can be good things and bad things that can trigger you to go into your sympathetic. That's my point. What are the warning signs that you're sliding back into this imbalance? So a couple of things that you can be aware of, and you might discover your own unique warning signs. But usually when you're sliding back out of balance, you're more irritable than normal. So your irritability increases. Then you find you're having trouble sleeping. You can't turn your brain off. Some people, they fall asleep for a couple hours and then they're just wide awake because their brain fires up. Or you might find that when you sit down to talk to somebody, you have a lot of trouble concentrating and being present to that person. Your brain wants to bounce all over the place. Or you feel the urge to, or the need to just dig deeper for more energy, to push yourself. That can be a warning sign. And so for many people, as they go into the imbalance with their sympathetic going all the time, they start to feel more and more robotic. Less emotional, more just going through the motions. And then another warning sign for some people is they become more impulsive. They do stuff without thinking. And so learn your warning signs, because the quicker you can catch yourself that you're sliding into imbalance, the better that you can get yourself corrected and back to a healthy balance. So that's the first thing. Second thing, you have to train yourself to activate your parasympathetic nervous system. So let me just give you some practical tools regarding that. What they have found is one of the best ways to activate your parasympathetic nervous system is deep breathing. Slow, deep breathing. And as you do that, it activates your parasympathetic nervous system. So a lot of people, they will do some deep breathing in the evening before bedtime. And there's different kind of types of deep breathing, but all of those are very helpful. And so last time we talked about your top-down approach and your bottom-up approach. So your top-down approach is using your cortex to try to regulate your nervous system. Your bottom-up is saying, I can't think my way through it right now. I need to do something to help regulate my nervous system, which is bring in my parasympathetic and settle down my sympathetic. Breathing gets the brain stem to relax. So that is an important thing. Next thing for many people is they can't unwind from their sympathetic to their parasympathetic in the snap of a finger. It takes them time to transition from being in their sympathetic to their parasympathetic. I had a dad who could be in a sympathetic, lay down, and in 2 minutes be fast asleep and switch into his parasympathetic. I can't do that. It takes me hours to unwind. So what I have learned the hard way is I need to be very careful about how I use my evenings. I can maybe have one evening a week where I'm doing something, but most evenings I need to start unwinding about supper time, where I'm starting to relax. I'm not going to meetings. I'm not reading stuff that's going to get my brain going. I'm not involving myself in conversations with people that could have conflict or problem solving. I'm not watching high energy type movies. All of those things, that would just get my sympathetic nervous system going again, and then I wouldn't be able to sleep. So I have to be very careful about how I use my evenings if I'm going to unwind and transition into my parasympathetic nervous system. Then I've had to realize that basically when I'm in my sympathetic nervous system, it's like a car engine. It revs up to 10,000 RPM. And when I was young, I loved my car engine at 10,000 RPM. My sympathetic nervous system doesn't kick in until I get that car engine down to 1 or 2,000 RPM. And so that's what the slowing the RPMs does in the evening. But what I need to do regularly through the day is stop myself and go, what is my RPMs on my internal engine right now? And I go, whoa, it's about 8,000. Okay, that's okay right now. But then later in the day, it's still 8,000, but whoa, it's 7 o'clock at night. This is not a good thing. That I should be starting to get down. So I need to develop a way to check in with myself, to check out what my RPMs are, to see, am I in my sympathetic or my parasympathetic, and is this the right time to be in my sympathetic, or should I be in my parasympathetic? The next thing that I realized about myself was because my normal for so many years was being in my sympathetic, I could have times in a day where all of a sudden I just had an urge to go into my sympathetic and get an adrenaline shot. And I had to stop that from happening. I had to learn to put the reins on it. Everything in me wanted to rev up the engine, put my foot on the gas, and I had to, whoa, we're not going there. I didn't like that. But I had to relearn how to live. And that's really what this is all about. So the next thing is to understand that when I give in and go into my sympathetic nervous system, it will resist slowing down if I try to slow it down after only a short period of time. So if I give in and go into my sympathetic nervous system, and then I go, oh, I shouldn't have done that, and an hour has passed and I want to slow it down, it's going, whoa, no, I'm just getting going here. I want to keep going. And so it, once it's activated, it doesn't want somebody to put the reins on it. So that was important for me to realize, is if I give into it, I can't just kid myself and say, okay, I'll just give into it for an hour and then I'll stop. That doesn't work well for me. And so don't give into it at all. So those are just, you learn about yourself. Now everybody's different, you might be different, but find out about yourself. Become self-aware of the issues that you have around your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, now let me take this one step further to the challenges we face in recovery. So recovery, if I am going to get healthy, requires that I build healthy routines, healthy structure. So I get up and I do things in the morning to kind of get myself in a good headspace, to connect to myself, to connect with others. Then I do my unwind things in the evening. All of these become important building blocks of a healthy life. It's routines, it's habits. But those can feel boring. And those are all all about helping our parasympathetic nervous system fulfill its role. And that feels boring. And so for people where their normal has been high activity, a healthy life feels boring. So be prepared for that. But once you get through that, what you find is that healthy routine and healthy habits, if they are healthy, actually leads to a deeper joy. So that is very important. Next thing, as a person gets healthier, they have less drama, less conflict, less problems, less crises in their life. And that feels boring to a person who's always been in their sympathetic nervous system. So getting healthier feels boring, which will trigger you to want to go back to your sympathetic nervous system. But then there's another thing. when things are going well, a person that came out of complex trauma goes, uh-oh, I don't like it when everything's going well because it's the other shoe's about to drop. Something bad's about to happen. And so what can happen for a lot of people when things are going well, they're really enjoying it and they go, wow, I love being in my parasympathetic nervous system. But then that old message in the brain goes, uh-oh, something bad's going to happen. Let's sabotage this good stuff so we go back to our sympathetic nervous system. So the bottom line is this. Getting healthy actually is triggering you to want to go back to the old way. Because it feels normal. Because that's your survival place. And so to go to a new healthy feels unnormal. It feels weird. It feels even wrong. So when I started to learn to relax and take care of myself and meet my 12 needs, I felt guilty. I felt I was being selfish. I was being lazy. Because my conscience had been mistrained. And so I had to retrain my conscience. I had to go through that weird transition time of feeling, oh, I'm being a bad person here by being healthy. It takes time. But after you do it for a while, your new normal feels normal. And then you're able to kind of be okay with it. So, there's one other piece to this sympathetic and parasympathetic that I want to give you that I hope will help you. Your sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system both experience emotions, okay? So they both have access to your limbic brain where your emotions are felt. But here's what I want you to understand. When you're in your sympathetic nervous system, you experience a lot of negative emotions, fear, stress, anger, but you also can experience pleasure, but you only experience a restricted package of pleasure. So think of it this way. When you're in your sympathetic nervous system, go, 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 you love a party. You love activities. You love playing sports. You love high activity game stuff. They give you pleasure, but you're in your sympathetic nervous system. Here's what they found out, and this is absolutely fascinating. Only in your parasympathetic nervous system can you feel contentment, satisfaction, joy. You can't experience contentment, peace, satisfaction, joy in your sympathetic nervous system. You can only experience pleasure, excitement, happiness. Does that explain why, for people coming out of complex trauma who are always in their sympathetic nervous system, they never felt joy. They never felt contentment. They always felt a restlessness, an antsiness. So they would seek out sympathetic nervous system pleasure, and that make them feel good for a while, but it didn't result in contentment. But they were incapable of experiencing that contentment because they were incapable of going to their parasympathetic nervous system. And so if we're going to experience true contentment and joy, we need to have the balance between our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Such an important point. Let me end by saying this. I referred in the first session to Dr. Bruce Perry, who's written the book, What Happened to You, which to me is one of the most excellent books around trauma available today. He was asked to go to a huge gathering of psychologists and medical people in New Zealand, and it was put on by the Maori tribal leaders. And so they, Western doctors and psychologists and all of them, came in with all of their Western approach to medicine and kind of all the stuff that we do in diagnosing, getting the right medication, the right treatment. And the Maori leaders heard all of this and they said, you guys have done so much to help us in our understanding of diseases and how the body works. But we really think you're missing the key component to a healthy life. The key component to a healthy life is connection. So here's what I want you to understand. This is, to me, mind-blowing. What they are finding is if you are connected to healthy people and you feel safe, that is mainly your parasympathetic nervous system will come into play. When your parasympathetic nervous system is working the way it is, so your stress isn't activating your sympathetic nervous system, your body is going to rest. Your body is going to heal itself. Your body is going to be able to deal with bacteria, viruses, way better than if you're in your sympathetic nervous system. And so what they found is societies where people have a very healthy parasympathetic nervous system and they don't let their stress systems be activated and put them into their sympathetic nervous system all the time, guess what? They have less heart problems. They have less cancer. They don't die at earlier ages. They have less diabetes, less autoimmune diseases. Why? Because they have a connection. And so what the Maori elders were saying, and I think we need to hear it, is if you want to get physically healthy, it's great that you have all your medications, but what are all your medications mainly for? Stress-related diseases. Due to lack of connection and lack of parasympathetic balance with sympathetic. If you guys really want to get physically healthy, start connecting. Start getting your parasympathetic working the way it should and in the right balance. That, I think, is such an important take-home.
The Wonderful Creative Power of the Mind. Introduction. There is a moment in every person's life when they pause, look at their circumstances, and whisper a quiet question that changes everything. What if the world I see is not the limit of what is possible? Perhaps you've felt this question rising in you for years. Perhaps you've sensed that there is more to your mind, more to your inner world, more to your potential than anyone ever told you. And perhaps that is why you're here now listening to these words. This is not an audiobook of theories. It is not a collection of nice ideas meant to entertain you. It is a doorway, a quiet opening into a truth that has always been waiting beneath the surface of your life. Your mind is the most creative force you possess, and you have barely begun to use it. If you listen closely, not just with your ears, but with your attention, you will begin to feel something awakening inside you. You will sense that your thoughts are not passive. They are alive, they are magnetic, they move ahead of you, shaping the road you walk long before your feet touch it. Everything you've struggled with, everything you've desired, everything you've feared, each of these has been responding to the vibration you carry, and the moment you change that vibration, your life begins to change with it. This audiobook is a guide to that transformation, not through force, not through blind optimism, but through understanding. You will learn how the mind truly works. How the conscious and subconscious interact, how desire becomes direction, how thought becomes vibration, how belief becomes reality. And most importantly, you will learn how to take back the inner authority you unknowingly gave away to circumstance, fear, and habit. Think of this as a conversation with a mentor who sees your potential clearly, perhaps more clearly than you see it yourself. A mentor who would never let you shrink into the smallness you've accepted for too long. A mentor who places a hand on your shoulder and says, "It is time to remember what you are capable of." As you move through these chapters, you will begin to feel something subtle but unmistakable, a shift, a rising, a sense of power returning to its rightful place within you. It will feel like clarity. It will feel like alignment. It will feel like waking up from a long sleep into a life that responds to you instead of the other way around. Stay with this audiobook. Let each idea unfold inside you. Let each chapter build its momentum. You are not just listening to words. You are activating the most powerful force you have ever known, the wonderful creative power of your own mind, and once you awaken it, your life will never be the same. Chapter 1. The Wonderful Creative Power of the Mind. There comes a moment in every person's life when they stop, look at the circumstances around them, and feel something stirring inside. A question, a whisper, a quiet recognition that something here isn't just happening by accident. Maybe you've felt it before. The sense that your experiences are somehow connected to the deeper movements of your own mind, that life is reflecting something back to you, even when you can't quite explain how. That's not imagination. It's not a coincidence. It is the beginning of understanding the wonderful creative power that has always lived within you. Most people drift through life without ever examining the force that shapes their destiny. They are pushed by circumstance, pulled by habit, swayed by moods, and influenced by the thoughts of others. They act as if life is something happening to them rather than something that is responding to them. But you are here now, and that alone tells me something important. You are beginning to wake up to the truth that your mind is not a passive observer. It is a creative instrument, a force, a magnet, a living center of energy capable of drawing into your experience exactly what harmonizes with its dominant state. I want you to hear this clearly, as if I were sitting across from you, speaking directly into your awareness. Your thoughts are not empty. Your thoughts are not trivial. Your thoughts are not harmless. Your thoughts are creative power in motion. Every idea you hold, every feeling you sustain, every belief you nurture, every expectation you cling to, they are all builders of your future. They are currents of energy moving outward and returning to you multiplied. Most people don't realize this because they never learn to look beneath the surface of life. They evaluate events only by what the physical senses show. They see a setback, and they call it bad luck. They see success, and they call it coincidence. They see relationships form or dissolve, and they attribute it to external forces. Rarely does anyone stop and ask, what thought was I consistently thinking? What feeling was I continually feeding? What expectation was I quietly rehearsing? Yet the truth remains, life mirrors the mind. It cannot do otherwise. Just as a magnet cannot help but attract iron, your mind cannot help but attract the experiences that match its inner vibration. You may try to fool yourself with positive words, but if your inner state is filled with fear or resentment or doubt, life will echo those vibrations with precise fidelity. And the opposite is also true. If you cultivate confidence, expectancy, and clarity of purpose, life will rise to meet that level with responses that seem almost miraculous to the untrained observer. Let's be honest for a moment, perhaps painfully honest. You have experienced both sides of this truth. You have seen times when everything fell into place with ease, almost as if life itself were helping you. You've also lived moments when everything seemed to work against you, when problems arrived in clusters and nothing responded to your efforts. These were not random seasons. They corresponded to your inner climate at the time. When your mind grew hopeful, open, trusting, and determined, the world seemed full of opportunity. When your mind grew fearful, resentful, discouraged, or confused, the world seemed filled with obstacles. And now you are beginning to see why. Your mind was not merely reacting, it was creating. It was selected. It was attractive. I'm not here to give you superstition or fantasy. I'm here to give you the truth that has been observed, tested, and rediscovered by thinkers for generations. Thought is a force. It is a vibration as real as sound or heat or light. It radiates outward through the mental atmosphere around you, and similar vibrations respond to it. Think of yourself as a broadcasting station. Every thought you think is a signal, and that signal doesn't vanish into nothingness. It enters the mental space we all share. A vast field of energy that connects every mind. Within this field, vibrations organize themselves around harmony. Fear resonates with fear. Confidence resonates with confidence. Anger resonates with anger. Love resonates with love. This is why someone in a bad mood seems to attract more negativity, and someone in an inspired state seems to open doors effortlessly. You have felt this before. Think of the days when you woke up feeling strong and ready. You felt capable. You felt that the world was wide open, and in that state, You recognized opportunities others overlooked. People were drawn to you. Solutions appeared where you once saw problems. This was not an accident. It was an attraction. Your positive, focused mental state placed you on a different frequency, allowing you to receive inspiration, assistance, and circumstances that matched your vibration. Now think of the days when you were weighed down by doubt. Everything irritated you. Everything seemed difficult. Even simple tasks felt heavy and draining. Your mind was tuned to a channel of limitation, and life echoed that state with situations that matched. Again, this was not an accident. It was the law of attraction at work, responding to the quality of your mental environment. This is where the conversation becomes critically important. If your mind holds the power to shape your experience, and it does, then responsibility and opportunity both rest in your hands. You cannot change the world by fighting it. You cannot bend circumstances through force alone. But you can change your inner state, and when you do, your outer life begins to shift accordingly. This is not instant magic. This is the law. This is cause and effect. This is the physics of consciousness. Let me speak plainly. The mind you possess right now is not fully used, not even close. You walk with a force in you that is stronger than your fears, greater than your past, deeper than your doubts, and capable of transforming your entire existence. But this force must be directed. It must be consciously applied. It must be taken seriously. Otherwise, it will continue operating by habit and accident, producing results that seem chaotic and inconsistent. Look at your life as it stands today. Observe it with clear eyes, not judgment. See the successes and the disappointments, the breakthroughs and the stagnations, the joys and the recurring challenges. They form a pattern. And that pattern reveals the kind of thoughts you've habitually entertained. Your relationships reflect your beliefs about connection, trust, and self-worth. Your finances reflect your beliefs about abundance, opportunity, and capability. Your emotional life reflects your beliefs about safety, identity, and possibility. Your career reflects your beliefs about competence, value, and direction. Life is a mirror, and the mirror is honest, even when we wish it wasn't. But here is the good news, perhaps the greatest news you will ever truly absorb. Mirrors don't create, they reflect. Change the source, and the reflection must follow. If you change your thinking, your world must rearrange itself. This isn't poetic language. This isn't motivational flavor. This is the mechanics of consciousness. Thought is the origin. Experience is the result. The invisible always precedes the visible. The inner always shapes the outer. You may have been taught otherwise. You may have been conditioned to believe that life responds to effort alone, or to luck, or to other people's decisions. But deep down, you know there is more to the story. You have sensed the moments in life when something aligned with you long before you took action. When doors opened because you believed. When opportunities appeared because you were ready. When life seemed to meet you halfway because you were willing to meet it with expectation. Let me reveal something essential. Life always meets you at the level of your belief. Not the beliefs you speak out loud, but the beliefs you hold quietly, deep within, in the private chambers of the mind. This chapter can change you if you let it, because once you accept that your mind is creative, that your thoughts are vibratory forces, that you are a magnet in a world of energy, then everything becomes possible. The limits you accepted as truth begin to dissolve. The identity you carried as a passive receiver of life begins to crack. You start to sense that you are not small. You are not powerless. You are not destined to remain as you are. You are the mental architect of your destiny, whether consciously or unconsciously. Most people live unconsciously. Their thoughts wander, drift, repeat, and recycle old patterns. They allow their minds to feed on fear, conflict, gossip, resentment, and doubt. And then they feel confused when life manifests the same conditions. They assume life is unjust when, in truth, they have been using the creative power of their mind in a destructive way. You cannot plant seeds of anxiety and expect a harvest of peace. You cannot plant seeds of indecision and expect a harvest of success. You cannot plant seeds of resentment and expect a harvest of love. You cannot plant seeds of lack and expect a harvest of abundance. Every thought is a seed, and your mind is always planting. Right now, as you listen to this, Your mind is generating vibrations. They will not disappear when this chapter ends. They will continue working, attracting, shaping, and forming. This book, this moment, this awakening, this is your opportunity to take control. Let me speak even more directly, because you deserve clarity. Nothing changes in your outer world until something changes in your inner world. You can change jobs, you can change partners, you can change locations, you can change routines, but if your mind remains the same, your results will eventually repeat themselves. The circumstances may look new, but the pattern will be familiar because the cause hasn't shifted. Change the mind, and the world changes with it. This is why understanding the creative power of thought is the foundation of all personal transformation. You cannot build a new life on an old mental foundation. You cannot attract new experiences with old vibrations. You cannot step into a higher level of living with a lower level of thinking. Your thoughts must rise before your life can rise. Your beliefs must expand before your opportunities can expand. Your expectations must grow before your results can grow. This is the law. Now, as your mentor in this moment, let me give you something practical, something you can begin using right away. And remember, this is not a ritual or a charm. This is alignment. This is training. This is discipline. Before you take any action in your day, pause for just a few seconds, take a breath, and ask yourself one simple question. What vibration am I carrying right now? If the vibration is fear, acknowledge it. If there's doubt, acknowledge it. If it's confusion, acknowledge it. But do not stop there. Ask a second question. What vibration will serve me better? This question awakens your creative power. It interrupts the automatic flow of your habitual thoughts and gives you the chance to choose deliberately. And when you choose deliberately, you raise your vibration. You shift your frequency. You begin to set into motion a new pattern of attraction. This is where will becomes your ally. You don't have to feel powerful to choose a powerful thought. You don't have to feel confident to choose a confident thought. You don't have to feel ready to choose a thought of readiness. Will is the bridge that carries you from your current vibration to your chosen vibration. And once you choose it, once you hold it even for a moment, the creative power of the mind begins responding. Do this often enough, and your entire life will shift. Not suddenly, not magically, but inevitably. For the law cannot fail. You cannot think one thing and experience another. You cannot hold one vibration and attract its opposite. You cannot sow one seed and reap a different harvest. And now, as we bring this first chapter to a close, I want you to sit with a thought, a truth, that may challenge you at first, but will eventually liberate you more deeply than anything you've believed before. Everything in your life has come through the door of your own mind, and everything that will come is already waiting at the threshold of your next thought. Your mind is wonderful. Your mind is powerful. Your mind is creative. And beginning now, you will learn to use it deliberately, consciously, and harmoniously with the laws that govern this universe. This is the first step, the inward shift, the awakening to your creative nature. Once you grasp this, even faintly, the rest of your life begins to change. And as we move forward together, chapter by chapter, you will not simply learn these truths, you will begin to embody them. Chapter 2, The Mind as a Living Magnet. You've taken the first step by realizing that your thoughts are not shadows passing through your awareness. They are forces, real forces, shaping everything around you. Now it's time to go deeper into this truth by understanding something that most people never stop to consider. Your mind is a broadcasting station, constantly sending out signals, constantly receiving them, constantly interacting with an invisible field of energy that surrounds us all. Whether you are conscious of it or not, you are influencing this field every moment you are awake. And even when you sleep, the impressions you have made upon your subconscious continue to vibrate through it. The mind never stops sending, the mind never stops attracting, the mind never stops shaping. Imagine for a moment that your thoughts are like ripples moving across a vast, silent lake. Each ripple may seem small at first. You may even imagine it disappears quickly. But the truth is that every ripple moves outward in all directions, interacting with other ripples, touching distant shores. returning in subtle ways you may not immediately recognize. When you think a thought, no matter how simple, you have initiated a vibration that travels far beyond your physical body. And here is the remarkable part. These vibrations do not fade into emptiness. They reproduce. They awaken similar vibrations in other minds. Just as a tuning fork causes another tuning fork to resonate when both share the same pitch. This is not metaphorical language. This is the nature of the mind. You have felt it yourself. You have walked into a room and instantly sensed the tension, even when nobody said a word. You have stood beside someone who radiated calm, strength, warmth, or joy, and without a single sentence, you felt their atmosphere influence you. You have also encountered people whose thoughts seemed heavy, whose presence drained your energy, whose internal state you could feel even before you fully understood it. These are not mystical impressions. They are responses to mental vibrations. Your mind does not merely think, it vibrates, and every vibration calls out to the universe, seeking its own kind. Thoughts of fear call forth more fear. Thoughts of confidence summon confidence. Thoughts of lack draw situations that reflect lack. And thoughts of abundance open doors you once thought were shut. You attract what you are in harmony with. You receive what you are tuned to. That is why two people living side by side may experience life in completely different ways. One sees opportunity everywhere, while the other sees only obstacles. One feels supported by life, while the other feels attacked by it. The difference between them is not fate, nor luck, nor chance. It is thought. Let me speak plainly again as your mentor in this moment. Your mind is a magnet, and like any magnet, it does not choose what it attracts consciously. It attracts according to its nature. If you want different results, you must change the nature of your mental magnet. You cannot continue thinking thoughts of limitation and expect life to respond with expansion. You cannot indulge in thoughts of discouragement and hope that life will bring encouragement. And you cannot repeatedly entertain thoughts of unworthiness and expect relationships, opportunities, and experiences that reflect confidence and value. The magnet cannot pull what does not match its vibration. But this truth is not meant to scold you. It is meant to liberate you. Because once you understand that your mind is attracting at all times, you realize something extraordinary. You can change what you attract by changing what you think. You no longer have to feel like a victim of circumstance. You no longer need to wonder why certain patterns repeat. You no longer have to accept what shows up in your life as if it were fate. You are not powerless. You are not helpless. You are not confined to the conditions you see today. You have within you the power to retune your vibration. Let's take this a step further. You are not only sending out vibrations, you are also receiving them. The world is filled with thoughts, emotions, expectations, and beliefs that are flowing through the mental atmosphere. People broadcast their inner world without even realizing it. The fearful broadcast fear, the angry broadcast anger, the hopeful broadcast hope, the confident broadcast confidence. And your mind, if left unattended, will pick up whatever matches its current state. This is why your mood can shift suddenly when you are around certain people, even before a conversation begins. This is why the world feels heavier when you are burdened by worry, and lighter when you are filled with enthusiasm. You are not isolated. You are connected to a sea of thought. And the key to navigating this sea is not to hide from it, nor to fight it, but to raise your own mental level so that you are no longer influenced by the lower vibrations around you. When you consciously elevate your state, when you choose thoughts of strength, clarity, courage, and expectation, you rise above the thick fog of negative thought that surrounds so many people. Suddenly you are not merely receiving, you are radiating. You become the influencer of energy rather than the follower of it. You become a source of clarity instead of a sponge for confusion. You become the one who sets the tone instead of the one who absorbs it. This is what mental mastery feels like. It begins subtly. You notice that certain things no longer bother you. You feel less influenced by the moods of others. You sense an inner steadiness, as if something inside you has solidified. You stop reacting automatically to circumstances. And then something almost magical happens. Life begins reacting to you. You will see people respond differently. You will notice opportunities that were always near but invisible to your old vibration, you will feel guided, supported, and connected to something greater than yourself, and you will understand that this was not luck, it was alignment. The moment your thoughts became intentional, your life began to reorganize itself around them. This is the creative power of the mind in motion. This is the law responding to your inner state, and this is only the beginning. Chapter 3. The Two Minds Within You. There is a moment in everyone's inner journey when they realize that the mind they have been living with is not a single, unified thing. It behaves differently at different times. Sometimes it feels alert and decisive, and other times it drifts as if operating under its own spell. One moment you feel in command of your thoughts, and the next you are watching them run in every direction without your consent. This inconsistency confuses many people, but it becomes clear once you understand that the human mind is not one mind but two, each playing a different role in shaping your life. You have an active mind, and you have a passive mind. At first glance, they may seem like poetic descriptions, but the more deeply you observe yourself, the more obvious their distinction becomes. The active mind is the part of you that chooses, decides, initiates, focuses, analyzes, and directs. It is the seat of your will. It is the part of you that says, I will think this, or I will do that, or I choose this direction. It is the commander. When you consciously take hold of an idea and move it forward, the active mind is at work. But beneath this surface there is another mind, a quiet, obedient, steady worker. It remembers everything you impress upon it. It repeats patterns without questioning them. It responds to suggestion, habit, emotion, repetition, and vivid imagination. It is the part of you that keeps thinking a thought after you have stopped paying attention to it. It is the part of you that reacts instantly to certain situations because it has learned those reactions through repetition. This is the passive mind, and though it does not choose, it shapes much of your daily experience. It has been forming the background of your life long before you learned its existence. Most people live unaware of this division. They believe that all their thoughts arise from the same place. They believe that every fear, every doubt, every negative impulse is fully under their control, when it isn't. The passive mind absorbs everything it is fed, whether consciously or unconsciously. It takes impressions from childhood, from society, from intense emotional moments, from repeated statements spoken to yourself, from the words of others, from habits of thinking that have been playing in the background for years. And once these impressions are accepted, the passive mind expresses them, reproduces them, and influences your actions and feelings without your permission. Think of this clearly. If you do not take hold of your mind deliberately, you will live the life created by your old impressions. You will react according to patterns formed by moments you barely remember. You will feel emotions that belong to old beliefs. You will make decisions influenced by ancient fears. This is what happens to people who never wake up to their deeper mental processes. They live the life written by their past. But you are not destined to repeat your past. The moment you understand the two minds within you, everything changes. The active mind holds the power of direction. It can choose a new thought. It can create a new belief. It can impress a new pattern on the passive mind. And once impressed, the passive mind will express it automatically, effortlessly, continuously. It will become your new emotional baseline, your new set of reactions, your new way of walking through life. This is why your active mind is the most valuable tool you possess. Through it, you can train the passive mind. And once trained, the passive mind works day and night to manifest the vibration you have chosen. But this requires awareness, discipline, and sincerity. It cannot be done casually. You must become conscious of what you allow your mind to dwell on. You must become intentional about what you repeat to yourself, because repetition is the gateway to the passive mind. What you tell yourself often enough with enough feeling becomes accepted as truth. And once accepted, it becomes the silent force shaping your experiences. Many people attempt to change their lives but fail because they only use their active mind temporarily. They choose a positive thought for a moment or affirm a new idea once or twice, but they do not hold it long enough for the passive mind to accept it. They plant a seed, but never water it. They try a new belief for a day, but return to their old patterns by evening. And then they conclude that change is difficult. But change is not difficult. It is simply unfamiliar. The passive mind needs repetition. It needs persistence. It needs emotional intensity. Once it accepts an idea, it holds it with astonishing strength. Let me give you an example you already know from your own life. Think of a habit you've had for years, maybe a pattern of worrying or reacting with impatience, or doubting yourself before trying something new. Those reactions feel automatic because the passive mind has rehearsed them countless times. But imagine if you impressed upon it a new pattern, confidence, clarity, calm, expectation. At first, your active mind will need to guide every moment of this new pattern, but if you hold it, the passive mind will eventually adopt it, and the new response will become just as automatic as the old one. Understanding this dual nature of your mind is the key to mastery. You cannot change the passive mind by force. You cannot fight it, argue with it, or suppress it. You must train it gently, consistently, and deliberately by choosing your thoughts with the active mind and repeating them until the passive mind accepts them. This is how new beliefs are formed. This is how new emotional habits are created. This is how the law of attraction becomes a conscious tool instead of an unconscious force. And here is the most empowering truth of all. Once the passive mind accepts a belief, it begins to vibrate with that belief. It broadcasts that vibration continuously, attracting experiences that match it. Your life begins to shift in ways that seem almost magical, but it is not magic. It is law. It is cause and effect. It is the natural outcome of a mind that has been unified instead of divided. You now stand at the threshold of this understanding. Once you master the relationship between your active and passive mind, you will no longer wonder why your life unfolds the way it does. You will know, and you will be able to direct it. Chapter 4. The Will. Your Power to Command Thought. There is a quiet moment in every person's evolution when they discover something astonishing about themselves. They realize that no matter how many thoughts rush through the mind, no matter how many emotions rise and fall, no matter how loud the world becomes, there is still something inside that can say, stop, and everything obeys. Something inside that can say, go, and the mind begins to move. Something inside that can say, I choose this, and suddenly a new direction opens. That something is the will. The will is not loud. It does not shout. It does not force itself upon you. It is not tied to emotion, and it is not weakened by fear. It sits quietly at the center of your being, waiting for you to recognize it. Many people mistake the will for strain or effort. They think willpower is something you clench your fists to create, something that requires tension or pressure. But true will is calm. True will is steady. True will is the silent authority that can redirect the entire mind with a single decision. To understand the creative power of your mind, you must understand the will. Without it, the active mind drifts like a feather in the wind, blown around by passing thoughts, external influences, and emotional impulses. But with the will, the mind becomes a disciplined instrument, capable of holding a thought long enough for it to impress the passive mind, capable of rising above fear, capable of choosing its vibration instead of inheriting it from the world. Most people never use their will consciously. They mistake desire for will. They mistake excitement for will. They mistake emotion for will. But desire without will drifts. Excitement without will fades. Emotion without will is unstable. Only will can hold a thought steady long enough for the law of attraction to respond. Only will can quiet the chaotic chatter of the mind. Only will can establish a deliberate direction. Imagine for a moment that you are standing at the center of a vast room filled with hundreds of voices. Some of these voices are memories from your past. Some are worried about the future. Some are the opinions of others. Some are the expectations of society. Some are old habits that you never meant to adopt. Some are faint desires. Some are loud fears. Without will, you try to listen to all these voices at once and your mind becomes overwhelmed. But the moment you activate your will, something extraordinary happens. All the voices fall silent, except the one you choose. The will is the director of your inner world. It is the faculty that decides which thought is permitted to stay and which must go. It is the guardian of your vibration. And when you use it deliberately, your entire mental state begins to shift. Think of the last time you felt scattered. Thoughts were pulling you in different directions. You wanted to focus, but the mind would not settle. In that moment, the will had not been awakened. Now think of a moment when you were determined. You made a decision with clarity. You set your focus on something, and everything else faded into the background. That was the will at work. When you choose a thought and hold it with your will, even if only for a few seconds, you activate a level of mental power that most people never touch. This is why the will is essential in the process of aligning with the law of attraction. You must not only desire something, you must choose it. You must not only imagine something, you must hold it. You must not only wish for something, you must fix your mind on it long enough for the universe to respond. Let me speak plainly. You do not need to strengthen your will. You need to strengthen your obedience to it. The will is already strong. It is your loyalty to it that has weakened through years of distraction, emotional reactivity, and habitual thinking. The will does not need to be built, it needs to be used. Each time you choose a thought deliberately, the bridge between your conscious intention and your inner power becomes stronger. The will is not the opposite of surrender. It is the beginning of it. You use your will to choose the vibration you want, and then you surrender the how and when to the deeper intelligence that responds to your vibration. You say, "I choose confidence," and the will establishes it. You say, "I choose gratitude," and the will holds it. You say, "I choose clarity," and the will clears a space for it. Once the vibration is formed, life moves into alignment. You may think this requires great effort. It doesn't. It requires only awareness. When an unhelpful thought enters your mind, you need only say, "Not this," and choose again. When fear tries to take over, you need only pause, breathe, and say, "I choose courage." When doubt arises, you quiet it by choosing certainty. Each choice builds strength. Each choice trains the passive mind. Each choice clarifies your vibration. You have lived long enough reacting to thoughts you did not choose. Now it is time to choose the thoughts you will react to. The will makes this possible. And as you begin to direct your inner world with purpose, you will find that outer circumstances respond in a way that seems almost uncanny. People will treat you differently. Opportunities will appear. Obstacles will dissolve. And you will know that these changes were not coincidences. They were the result of a mind held in place by the quiet, unwavering force of your will. The will is your power to command thought, and once you claim that power, nothing in your life will remain the same. Chapter 5. Rising Above the Negative Current. There comes a time in your mental training when you begin to notice something about the world around you. You see that most people are not thinking. They are reacting. They are not directing their minds. They are being pulled by the strongest vibration in their environment. If the world is fearful, they fear. If the world is angry, they are angry. If the world is doubtful, they doubt. They do not choose their mental state. They inherit it from the collective atmosphere. And yet, without realizing it, they continue to attract experiences that match this borrowed vibration. This is the negative current of thought that surrounds humanity like a fog, and if you wish to rise above it, you must understand it. The negative current is not a mysterious force. It is the accumulation of millions of untrained minds radiating worry, resentment, anxiety, anger, pessimism, suspicion, and self-doubt. It forms a mental climate that affects the sensitive, the unaware, and the unguarded. You have walked into this current many times. You have felt its heaviness in the air. You have sensed it in conversations, in the news, in the collective mood of society. And if you were not alert, you absorbed it. Suddenly, your thoughts were not entirely your own. Your inner world darkened, not because something terrible happened, but because you tuned into the vibration of the collective without even knowing it. This is why mental mastery is essential. If you do not rise above the negative current, you will spend your life reacting to it. You will think thoughts that are not truly yours. You will carry emotional burdens that have nothing to do with your personal experience. You will find yourself discouraged without reason, irritated without cause, and fearful without justification. The negative current is not personal, but it becomes personal the moment you accept it. But here is the truth that will free you. You do not have to accept it. You can hold your own mental atmosphere. You can decide the tone of your inner world. You can choose the vibration in which you live. And once you learn to do this, the negative current can sweep around you without touching you, like a river that flows past a stone. You have already felt moments of this strength. Think back to a time when you woke up with a sense of determination and nothing could shake it. Even if someone else was irritated, you didn't absorb their mood. Even if circumstances were chaotic, you stayed centered. In those moments, your vibration was stronger than the vibration around you. You were not influenced. You were influencing. You were not reacting. You were radiating. And in that state, the negative current had no power. You can make that state your daily baseline. It begins with awareness. When you sense heaviness, anxiety, or discouragement arising without a clear cause, pause for a moment and ask yourself, "Is this mine?" You will be surprised how often the honest answer is no. The feeling may be real, but its origin is external. You tuned into a vibration that did not belong to you. The moment you recognize it, you can release it. The moment you say, "This is not mine," the spell breaks. But awareness is only the first step. The next step is elevation. You cannot rise above the negative current by resisting it, fighting it, or trying to push it away. Resistance only strengthens the bond. Elevation is the key. You rise by reaching for a higher vibration, clarity, gratitude, strength, calm, confidence. When you choose a higher thought deliberately, your mind shifts frequencies. It's as if you tune yourself to a different station, one where the negative current cannot reach you. You don't fight it, you surpass it. Imagine two pianos in the same room. If someone strikes a note on one, the same string in the other begins to vibrate. This is resonance. But if the second piano is tuned to a higher octave, the lower vibration cannot activate it. This is how you must become. You must tune yourself higher than the negativity around you. When you do, you stop resonating with fear, anger, and pessimism. You become immune to them. This elevation is not accomplished through intensity. It is accomplished through steadiness. Each time you choose a clear, strong, confident thought, you shift upward. Each time you refuse to dwell on worry, you shift upward. Each time you hold your vibration intentionally, you shift upward. Eventually, you reach a height where the negative current cannot touch you, because it cannot match your frequency. And at this point, something remarkable happens. You begin to attract experiences that reflect your elevated state. People respond to you differently. They sense your steadiness. They sense your clarity. They sense your inner strength. The opportunities that once seemed out of reach begin to appear. Circumstances that felt heavy begin to lighten. You become a point of stability in a world drowning in reaction, and life organizes itself around the vibration you maintain. This is not arrogance. This is alignment. This is what happens when you cease absorbing the world and begin emanating into it. You stop being shaped by your environment and begin shaping your environment instead. You walk through life like a calm flame in a windy field, untouched, steady, luminous, because the power within you is stronger than the atmosphere around you. The negative current is strong only when your mind is unguarded. The moment you choose your vibration consciously, its power fades. And as this mastery develops, you will discover a profound truth. You do not have to escape the world to rise above its negativity. You simply have to rise within yourself. Once your inner elevation becomes stable, the world cannot pull you down. You are meant to rise. You are meant to hold your own tone. You are meant to be a point of clarity in a world of confusion. And as you continue this journey, you will learn not only to resist the pull of the negative current, but to lift others by the quiet radiance of your own vibration. Chapter 6. Desire. The magnetic force that shapes your destiny. There is a power in you that most people misunderstand, and because they misunderstand it, they either fear it, deny it, or suppress it. That power is desire. Desire has been so misinterpreted that many have come to see it as something dangerous, something selfish, something to be resisted. Yet nothing could be further from the truth. Desire is not weakness. Desire is not greed. Desire is not immaturity. Desire is the very pulse of life moving through you. It is the instrument through which the universe whispers, "This is the direction of your growth." Every great change in your life, every moment of courage, every step into the unknown, every breakthrough you have ever experienced, began with a desire. Even when the desire was faint or fragile, it was still the spark. Desire is the first movement of creation. It is the seed of intention. It is the beginning of the vibration that will eventually attract its own expression. Without desire, nothing begins. Without desire, nothing is created. Without desire, the mind has no direction to move toward. And yet, so many people walk through life desiring nothing deeply. Their wants are shallow, scattered, and half-hearted. They wish they could have this or that, but they do not desire it with any intensity. They hope vaguely, but they do not feel strongly. They declare goals, but their hearts are not in them. A weak desire produces a weak vibration, and a weak vibration produces weak results. The universe does not respond to lukewarm longing. It responds to the mind that knows what it wants. Think of the times in your life when you truly desired something, not merely wished for it, not merely thought it would be nice, but genuinely desired it. Whether it was a goal, a relationship, a change, or an opportunity, notice what happened inside you. Your energy rose, your focus sharpened, your mood shifted. You became more alive, more aware, more purposeful. That is because desire increases your inner vibration. It ignites the will. It awakens the imagination. It begins the process of attraction. Desire is the soul's compass. It points you toward expansion. It calls you into the life you are meant to grow into, not the life you have already lived. And because desire is so powerful, it must be understood correctly. Desire is not about demanding specific outcomes. It is not about forcing reality into a shape you cling to. It is not about craving something from a place of lack. True desire is a quiet but powerful recognition of what resonates with your inner nature. It feels like expansion, not desperation. It feels like clarity, not fear. It feels like a natural forward pull, not a frantic grasping. Many people misunderstand their desires because they confuse surface wants with deeper longings. A surface want is something the mind picks up from comparison, social pressure, or ego. These wants change constantly, and they carry little creative power. Deeper desire is different. It comes from within. It is persistent. It is energizing. It is meaningful. When you feel a true desire, it does not drain you. It strengthens you. It awakens a part of you that may have been dormant for years. You must learn to trust your deeper desires. They reveal the path your mind is ready to create. They are not random. They are not foolish. They are not fantasies. They are invitations. When you honor them, you align with the creative power of your mind. When you ignore them, you cut off a vital source of energy, direction, and purpose. Desire makes you magnetic. It sets a vibration in motion that draws opportunities, people, insights, and resources into your orbit. The stronger and clearer the desire, the more powerful the attraction. But desire must be paired with belief. If you desire something but believe it is impossible, your vibration becomes conflicted. If you desire something but believe you are unworthy of it, you create resistance. If you desire something but fear what it requires, your energy weakens. This is why understanding desire requires understanding yourself. When you feel a strong desire, you must ask yourself a simple question. Do I believe this is possible for me? If the answer is yes, your vibration aligns and the attraction begins. If the answer is no, then your work is not to abandon the desire, but to elevate your belief to match it. The desire came from a higher part of you. Let your belief rise to meet it. Think of a desire as a note you strike in the great symphony of life. When the note is clear and unwavering, it resonates outward, awakening similar vibrations. People appear who are tuned to that note. Circumstances align, ideas flow, synchronicities multiply. But if the note is weak or unstable, if you doubt, hesitate, or contradict yourself, the vibration cannot sustain itself long enough to attract its corresponding expression. This is why desire requires commitment, not force, not strain. Commitment. A quiet, steady willingness to hold the vibration of what you want, to nurture it, to believe in it, and to act in harmony with it. Desire is the beginning, but the will sustains it. Belief strengthens it. Action expresses it. Some will tell you that desire is dangerous, that it leads to suffering. But desire only leads to suffering when you cling to it with desperation or when you resist the changes it requires. When you understand desire as a creative signal rather than a craving, you realize it is one of the greatest gifts you possess. It shows you where life is calling you upward, and when you follow that call with clarity and trust, desire becomes fulfillment. There is nothing selfish about wanting to grow, to create, to expand, to express more of your potential. Desire is the engine of evolution. It is the mechanism through which consciousness unfolds. When you deny your desires, you deny your growth. When you honor them, you come alive. The universe responds to the vibration of your desire, not your words. You cannot whisper, "I want," while holding a vibration of doubt and expect the world to deliver. You must become the vibration of what you seek. And when you do, life rushes to meet you. Your desires are not random. They are messages. And as you learn to listen, you will discover that each one carries the seed of a greater version of yourself. Chapter 7. Planting thoughts in the subconscious mind. There is a quiet engine running beneath every moment of your life. You rarely hear it, yet it never stops working. It shapes your habits, directs your emotions, influences your choices, and colors your perception of the world. This engine is your subconscious mind. It is the silent builder behind every belief you hold, the guardian of every pattern you express, and the ground in which every seed of thought eventually takes root. You may think you are governed by logic and deliberate choice, but most of what you do, feel, and attract comes from this deeper layer of mind. The subconscious does not argue, does not analyze, and does not question. It accepts whatever is impressed upon it, and expresses it with unwavering loyalty. And because it operates automatically, many people spend their entire lives living out patterns they never consciously chose. To master the creative power of your mind, you must understand one of the most important truths about yourself. The subconscious is programmable. It does not care whether the ideas fed into it are empowering or harmful, uplifting or damaging. It simply receives, stores, and expresses. What you repeatedly think, imagine, feel, or affirm becomes the script by which the subconscious directs your experience. This is why the same thoughts keep returning to you. This is why certain emotions appear almost instantly in specific situations. This is why some patterns in your life repeat, even when you consciously want them to change. The subconscious is acting out the instructions you gave it long ago, often without realizing it. And the only way to transform your life is to rewrite those instructions. The method for doing this is simple, but not always easy. You impress the subconscious through repetition, imagination, emotion, and steady intention. This process is called auto-suggestion. It is the art of choosing a thought deliberately, holding it long enough with enough feeling, and repeating it consistently until the subconscious accepts it as truth. Once accepted, it becomes automatic. It becomes the new pattern. It becomes your new inner vibration. Some people misunderstand this process. They think affirmations are about reciting words like a ritual, as if the sound itself carried the magic. But the subconscious is not moved by empty statements. It is moved by ideas that are repeated, envisioned, and felt. It responds to conviction, not mere language. You could say, "I am confident," 1,000 times, but if your inner feeling contradicts it, the subconscious receives the contradiction, not the statement. But if you begin softly, gently, and with sincerity, "I am learning confidence, I am becoming more confident, confidence is growing in me," the subconscious begins to listen, it begins to soften, it begins to accept. This is because the subconscious reacts to impressions, not arguments. It does not respond to force. It responds to consistency. Just as a drop of water can carve stone through steady repetition, your chosen thoughts can carve new paths into the subconscious through continual suggestion. Let me put it plainly and directly, as a mentor would. If you want to change your life, you must change what you tell yourself when no one is listening. You must become aware of the thoughts you repeat, the internal language you use, the quiet statements you whisper about yourself, others, and life itself. These daily mental conversations are instructions written into the deeper layers of your mind, and the subconscious, ever obedient, takes them seriously. People who constantly tell themselves life is hard, I always struggle, nothing ever works out for me, I am unlucky, I am not enough, are planting seeds that the subconscious will faithfully grow. It does not judge these beliefs. It simply brings them into expression. But people who choose thoughts like life supports me, I am capable, opportunities find me, I attract what I need, I am becoming stronger, are planting new seeds, and the subconscious will grow those with equal fidelity. Your job is not to fight the old patterns. Fighting them only energizes them. Your job is to consistently impress new patterns until the old ones lose their power. The subconscious does not hold on to beliefs out of stubbornness. It holds on because you keep feeding them attention. The moment you withdraw your attention and feed the new ones, the balance begins to shift. One of the most powerful techniques you can use is visualization. When you imagine something vividly, your subconscious responds as if it were real. It registers the feeling, the image, the energy. Emotion amplifies this effect. When you imagine your desired state with feeling, calm, confidence, clarity, abundance, the impression sinks deeper. It becomes a seed with potential to grow. And each time you revisit that image, the roots strengthen. You do not need long sessions. A few seconds of focused, sincere thought done consistently are more powerful than hours of scattered effort. The subconscious does not measure time, it measures intensity and repetition. A single moment of genuine belief can outweigh many hours of forced affirmation. And here is something else you must understand. The subconscious speaks the language of the present. It does not understand, someday, I will, or when I become. It responds to the vibration of now. When you say, I am becoming more aligned, I am attracting better experiences, I am worthy, I am ready, the subconscious receives these statements as present truth and begins working accordingly. This is why self-talk is not a small matter. It is the foundation of your vibration. It is the blueprint from which your experiences are constructed. You may not always be aware of it, but the subconscious never misses a word, never forgets an impression, never ignores a repeated thought. You are training your subconscious every moment of the day. The question is, are you training it consciously or unconsciously? Once you take control of this process, your life changes from the inside out. Things that once felt difficult become natural. Opportunities appear with less resistance. Certain fears dissolve. New emotions arise, and your entire outlook shifts. This is not a coincidence. It is the result of planting new seeds. Chapter 8. Becoming a Mental Magnet. There is a point in this journey when you begin to sense, not merely understand, that you are far more influential than you ever imagined. You start noticing that when your inner state is stable and elevated, people react differently. Situations unfold more smoothly. Solutions appear with less struggle. You walk into a room and feel as though the atmosphere shifts around you. This is not imagination. This is the beginning of magnetism. People often talk about charisma, confidence, presence, or energy, but these are only different ways of describing the same thing. A mind that radiates instead of absorbs, a mind that attracts instead of chases, a mind that has become magnetic. To become such a mind, you don't need special talents. You don't need to be born lucky. You don't need to force anything. You only need to understand and practice the laws that govern mental vibration. A mental magnet is not someone who tries to manipulate the world, but someone who aligns themselves so powerfully that the world begins to respond. They do not rush. They do not beg. They do not push against life. Their very presence conveys direction and certainty. It is not arrogance, it is inner coherence. When you think clearly, feel steadily, and act deliberately, you create a vibration strong enough for the universe to notice. And when the universe notices, it responds. But magnetism does not begin with action. It begins with desire. A vague, half-hearted desire produces only a faint vibration. A passionate, sincere desire ignites a strong vibration. The moment you genuinely want something, not to escape something else, not to prove anything, but because it resonates with you, your mind begins to organize itself around that aim. Desire focuses attention, and attention focuses vibration. That is the beginning of magnetism. Once you have a clear desire, the will strengthens it. You choose the thought again and again. You hold it even when distractions arise. You feed it with imagination, giving it shape and substance. You allow yourself to feel the emotional tone of having it, and gradually the desire stops feeling like a distant wish and begins feeling familiar, natural, inevitable. This is when the passive mind accepts it, and the moment the passive mind accepts it, you become magnetic to it. Your vibration is now broadcasting a clear signal. The world responds to this signal in ways that seem almost orchestrated. You meet people whose paths align with yours. You recognize opportunities that were invisible before. You feel nudged towards certain actions. You notice synchronicities, small signs that you are moving in harmony with the direction of your desire. These are not coincidences. They are reflections of your inner state. A mental magnet is someone who understands that their thoughts do not travel alone. Every thought carries feeling, and every feeling carries a vibration that calls for its own expression. When your thoughts and feelings point in the same direction, they amplify one another. That is why people who know what they want and believe they can have it seem to move through life with a natural ease. Their inner harmony creates outer harmony. But magnetism is not just about attracting things. It is about attracting things that match who you are becoming. The more you grow, the more life gives you experiences that reflect your growth. This is why your vibration matters more than your actions. You cannot attract abundance from a vibration of lack. You cannot attract love from a vibration of unworthiness. You cannot attract clarity from a vibration of confusion. A magnet does not pull what is unlike itself. So before you ask for anything, look at your vibration. Are you vibrating from fear or faith, from scarcity or expectancy, from insecurity or worthiness, from confusion or clarity? The world responds to the real vibration, not the words you speak. This is why inner alignment is so important. Alignment is not a mystical state. It is simply the coherence between your desire, your belief, your thoughts, your emotions, and your actions. When these elements point in the same direction, your vibration becomes strong and focused. That is magnetism. Consider someone who wants success but believes they are undeserving. Their desire and their belief contradict each other. The vibration is scattered. The magnet is weak. Now imagine someone who wants success, believes they are capable, thinks about success often, feels inspired when imagining it, and takes actions that reflect that belief. Their vibration forms a single, steady frequency. Their mind becomes a magnet for opportunities, ideas, and people aligned with success. You have felt glimpses of this alignment before. Think of a time when something you wanted came easily, almost effortlessly. You didn't question it. You didn't strain. You simply knew. That inner knowing is magnetism, and it can be cultivated intentionally. The simplest way to strengthen your magnetism is to act in harmony with your desired state. If you want confidence, think confidently, speak confidently, imagine confidently, and behave as someone who is growing into confidence. Do not wait for the feeling to come. Generate it. The subconscious responds to self-generated vibration. When the vibration becomes stable, the magnet becomes strong. Another important aspect of magnetism is emotional clarity. When your emotions are scattered, your vibration is scattered. When you feel something clearly, deeply, consistently, your vibration becomes powerful. This does not mean emotional intensity. It means emotional coherence. A quiet, steady feeling of expectancy is more magnetic than frantic yearning. Calm enthusiasm is more magnetic than restless desire. A relaxed certainty is more magnetic than desperate hope. People often think manifestation requires intense emotion, but intensity without coherence weakens the signal. Think of magnetism as light. A diffused light illuminates everything but focuses on nothing. A concentrated beam can travel miles, penetrate darkness, and draw the eye instantly. The same is true of your vibration. The more coherent it becomes, the more powerful its effect. As your magnetism grows, you will notice something else. You feel less affected by the world and more capable of affecting it. You stop chasing. You stop forcing. You stop worrying. You begin to trust the invisible process unfolding beneath the surface of your life. And that trust strengthens your vibration even more. Becoming a mental magnet is not about controlling the universe. It is about aligning with it. When your mind is clear, your desire is sincere, your belief is steady, and your emotion is coherent, life cannot help but respond. Chapter 9. The Power of Focus, Directing the Creative Current. There is a moment in every seeker's journey when they realize that they are not defeated by lack of intelligence, lack of opportunity, or lack of talent. They are defeated by scattered focus. The mind, when left untrained, behaves like light shining through a window. It illuminates everything, but burns nothing. Only when focused does light gain the power to ignite. Your mind is no different. Unfocused thought warms your intentions. Focused thought transforms your reality. Most people never learn to focus because they believe thought is something that simply happens. They allow their attention to wander to whatever is loudest, most familiar, or closest at hand. They jump from thought to thought like a bird flying from branch to branch with no destination in mind. By the end of the day, they wonder why nothing in their life has moved. But how could it? Nothing held their attention long enough to build momentum. Focus is the art of choosing one direction and refusing to be pulled away from it, not through strain, not through force, but through clarity. The moment you know what you want, the mind begins to align with it. The moment you choose a desire with sincerity, your thoughts begin to organize themselves around that choice. But focus requires something more than wanting. It requires commitment to a single mental direction. Think of the mind as a river. When it flows wide and shallow, it moves slowly and weakly. But when the banks narrow, the water gains force. It becomes powerful enough to carve stone. Your attention works the same way. If your thoughts are spread across dozens of concerns, desires, fears, and distractions, your energy becomes diluted. But when you hold one aim steadily, the force of your mind begins to cut through obstacles that once seemed immovable. You have experienced this before. Think of moments in your life when you were intensely focused, so absorbed in something that all other thoughts disappeared. Time moved differently. Distractions lost their power. You entered a state of flow where effort felt light and progress felt effortless. That state is natural to you. It is the mind working at its highest capacity. And the more often you enter it, the more magnetic your vibration becomes. To understand focus, you must recognize a simple truth. The mind cannot hold two opposing thoughts with power. It can think multiple ideas, yes, but it cannot sustain two contradictory vibrations. You cannot focus on abundance while constantly worrying about lack. You cannot focus on health while giving energy to fear. You cannot focus on love while nurturing resentment. The vibration you hold most consistently is the one that dominates your experience. This is why choosing a single, clear direction is so powerful. When your desire, belief, emotion, and attention point in the same direction, your vibration becomes coherent. And coherent vibration attracts quickly. It is not that the universe suddenly favors you, it is that you have finally stopped contradicting yourself. Many people weaken their focus by constantly shifting goals. They begin building one desire, then abandon it for another. They take a few steps forward and then retreat the moment discomfort appears. They scatter their energy across countless small wants instead of committing to a single meaningful one. And then they say, manifestation doesn't work. but it does. Their focus simply never held long enough for the creative power of the mind to bring results into form. Consistency is the secret behind focus. Not intensity, not obsession. Consistency. A calm, steady return to your chosen direction. Each time your mind wanders, you gently bring it back. Each time doubt appears, you acknowledge it and quietly redirect your attention. Each time fear whispers, you choose the vibration of your desire instead. You do this again and again until the mind begins to obey you. And once it obeys, your vibration becomes strong. Do not underestimate the power of small efforts made steadily. A single thought held clearly for a moment, repeated often enough, becomes a dominant vibration. A dominant vibration organizes your life. The world responds to the thoughts you hold most consistently, not the ones you think occasionally. Focus is not about forcing the mind into stillness. It is about training it to return to your intention with ease. Over time, the mind learns to prefer clarity over chaos. It learns to resist distraction. It learns to follow your direction. And when the mind begins to follow you, your life begins to follow your mind. One of the greatest obstacles to focus is impatience. People want results instantly. They plant a seed and dig it up the next day to see whether it is growing. They question the process. They doubt their worthiness. They shift desires midstream. Impatience disrupts vibration. When you become impatient, you signal uncertainty to the subconscious, and uncertainty weakens the magnet. But when you choose patience, when you trust the unseen process unfolding beneath the surface, your vibration stabilizes, and stable vibration attracts. Focus also requires saying no, not to the world, but to the unnecessary, to the voices that drain your energy, to the habits that scatter your attention, to the thoughts that do not support your desired direction. Each no strengthens your signal. Each act of clarity sharpens your vibration. Each decision to hold your mental ground transforms your magnetism. When your mind becomes focused, you stop chasing results. You stop reacting to every change in circumstance. You stop doubting your path at every small setback. Instead, you move with quiet certainty. You attract with minimal effort. You create without strain. You live in a state of inner conviction, knowing that the outer world will in time reflect what you hold within. Focus is not a talent, it is a discipline, and once cultivated, it becomes one of the most powerful tools you possess. Through it, your mind becomes a laser rather than a lantern, a force capable of cutting through distraction, dissolving obstacles, and illuminating the path ahead. You were not born to scatter your energy. You were born to direct it. And when you direct it with clarity, consistency, and intention, there is nothing in your life that cannot be transformed. Chapter 10. Living Above Circumstance. The Art of Conscious Alignment. There comes a moment in your mental development when you begin to realize something profound. Life does not move you. You move life. This realization does not arise from arrogance or wishful thinking. It emerges from the quiet understanding that your inner state shapes your outer experience. What you hold within becomes the lens through which you interpret the world, the magnet through which you attract experiences, and the energy through which events unfold. To live above circumstance is not to ignore reality, but to create reality consciously from a higher state of mind. Most people live in reaction. They wake up each day, waiting to see how life will treat them. If the world is kind, they feel good. If the world is harsh, they feel defeated. They drift from mood to mood, depending on traffic, weather, news, finances, or the emotional state of the people around them. Their vibration rises and falls based on external conditions, never realizing that by allowing circumstance to dictate their inner world, they unconsciously reinforce those same circumstances. This is the trap of reactive living. It keeps life exactly as it is. But you are learning something different. You are discovering that your vibration is not a reaction. It is a choice. It is a decision you make every moment. And when you choose your vibration instead of inheriting it, circumstance loses its power. You stop being tossed by the external world and begin to shape it through your inner alignment. Living above circumstance does not mean denying challenges. It means refusing to let them define your vibration. When something unwanted happens, you do not collapse into fear or frustration. You pause. You breathe. You choose your mental position. You acknowledge the situation without surrendering to it. You rise above it internally, and from that elevated place, new solutions, new ideas, new opportunities begin to reveal themselves. The challenge does not disappear instantly, but your relationship to it changes. And that change is everything. The universe responds to your dominant tone, not your temporary reactions. What you hold most consistently, your baseline of feeling and thought, determines what you attract. If your baseline is worry, life gives you more to worry about. If your baseline is gratitude, life gives you more to appreciate. If your baseline is fear, life echoes it. But if your baseline is trust, certainty, and clarity, life brings experiences that match those states. This is why inner work is the highest work. You can rearrange external conditions endlessly, but if the inner pattern remains the same, the outer pattern will eventually return. Changing your vibration is not about escaping your life. It is about transforming the point from which you engage with it. A change in vibration is a change in destiny. To live above circumstance, you must first know the difference between emotion and vibration. Emotions rise and fall like waves. They pass through you. They are momentary. Vibration is deeper. It is the quiet, steady hum beneath your emotional weather. It is the frequency you carry when you are not thinking intensely about anything. It is the tone of your subconscious mind. And that tone is what life listens to. You elevate your vibration not by suppressing emotions or pretending everything is perfect, but by choosing the thoughts you return to, the interpretations you adopt, and the direction you lean toward. Even when fear arises, you do not dwell in it. Even when frustration appears, you do not feed it. You notice, you breathe, and you choose again. Each choice strengthens your alignment. Living above circumstance also requires you to understand something essential about the law of attraction. Life does not respond to what you want. It responds to who you are. Your desires matter, but your vibration matters more. If you desire abundance but vibrate lack, the vibration wins. If you desire love but vibrate unworthiness, the vibration wins. If you desire peace but vibrate conflict, the vibration wins. The universe does not judge your desires, it mirrors your dominant signal. This is why the most powerful shift you can make is internal. When you become the person who naturally vibrates with your desire, the external world must eventually reflect it. This is not mysticism, it is alignment. You become a vibrational match to the reality you want. You stop reaching for it and begin resonating with it. When you resonate with it, you attract it. When you attract it, you experience it. This is the order of creation. Now, let's speak clearly, because you deserve clarity. Living above circumstance is not a one-time achievement. It is a practice. It is a daily calibration of your inner world. You will have days when the vibration wavers. You will face moments when the old patterns try to pull you back. But each time you choose alignment over reaction, you strengthen a new pathway. Eventually, alignment becomes natural. You no longer have to fight for it. You rest in it. When you live in alignment long enough, something extraordinary begins to happen. Circumstances that once disturbed you lose their power. Challenges that once intimidated you become manageable. Situations that once triggered you begin to dissolve before they reach you, because your vibration no longer resonates with them. You begin attracting a different caliber of experience. Opportunities aligned with your growth, people aligned with your frequency, circumstances aligned with your purpose. You are no longer living according to the world. You are inviting the world to live according to you. To live above circumstance is to understand that nothing external has the authority to dictate your inner state unless you give it that authority. And when you reclaim that inner authority, you reclaim your life. You walk not as someone reacting to fate, but as someone shaping it. You were not meant to be controlled by circumstance. You were meant to rise above it through the quiet, powerful, deliberate use of your own mind.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Well, welcome to another Friday night. We're moving along in our series on understanding trauma and how it affects us. And last time we looked at the fact that trauma causes people to be basically driven by, controlled by fear at this very deep level that they might not even be aware of. Tonight what I want to look at is you can't understand complex trauma without understanding that it makes angry people, makes a lot of anger. But most, again, aren't even aware of it. And that's what I'm going to try to explain to you so that you can become aware of it. Because what I've seen is that for many people, when I teach about anger, they go, I don't have any anger issues. The truth is that they've stuffed it down so far, they're not even aware of it to themselves. And many, by the time I'm done teaching, they'll come up to me afterwards and say, okay, now I'm angry at you. I've got anger issues. Most will say, I don't have anger issues, but maybe once in a while, my anger kind of gets flares up. Yeah, I do some damage at my job, with my kids, with my spouse, but otherwise I'm a pretty cool person. So they don't see those kind of crisis times where their anger escalates as being a super big problem. And so we're going to explore all of that. Another thing that many people don't even realize with their anger is that how much it's been directed at themselves. And they're constantly beating themselves up, putting themselves down. So I really hope tonight helps you become aware of this anger issue in your own life and gives you some practical understanding and practical tools in responding to that. Now let me just begin with kind of understanding the big picture of anger and complex trauma. If you were to talk to somebody that's coming out of complex trauma and ask them about the anger emotion, most of them would immediately just assume it's, oh, that's bad. Because everything in their experience, anger's been a bad thing. It's never been shown, or it's never been acted on in a healthy way. It's always hurt somebody. It's always been negative. And so it's just bad. So we got to start by kind of understanding, is there such a thing as healthy anger? What's it look like? What's its purpose? So let me take you to, there is a healthy anger. It does have a very important design. So think of it this way. Whenever there is dishonesty, so somebody lies to you, we get angry. When there's disrespect, somebody puts you down or puts somebody else down or your kids down, we get angry. Or they cheat on you or there's injustice, we get angry and we should. Why? Because that is unhealthy. If we keep lying to each other in this relationship is not going to be healthy. If we keep cheating, if we keep disrespecting, it is going to hurt us, hurt the relationship. So Anger is a warning sign, a signal, something is violating love. And what it does is it gives me energy and motivation to want to change that, to get it back to healthy. So what we're saying is, to have a healthy relationship, you live within the boundaries where there is honesty and respect and justice and faithfulness. But we just stepped outside of those boundaries, and we're going to be in trouble if we don't correct it and get back inside of the boundaries. So my anger is motivating me and giving me energy to say, we got to fix this. That is not good. We should not be allowing that. This needs to be resolved. And so anger, physiologically, gets some, even some help in doing that, called cortisol. And it gives us a turbocharge of energy to try and correct it. And so it's deep inside of us. We have an alarm system when stuff violates love. And when it does, anger comes in to try to correct it. That is the design. But what happened for most people in complex trauma? They lived every day as a child with things that violated love. They were disrespected. They were lied to. They were cheated on. There wasn't justice. All kinds, hundreds of things. And they got angry as little children. They cried. They complained. They had a temper tantrum. Did that anger result in fixing the problem and getting it back to love? No, in most cases, because the authorities in their life weren't concerned about getting it back to healthy. And so the child got punished for their anger. They got told they're bad for having their anger. And so now they're living with injustice, with lying, with disrespect, all of those things that violate love, which hurt like crazy. But now if they get angry, they'll get hurt even more. They'll get punished, shamed, rejected. And so what is their only option? If you can't resolve the things that violate love, stuff down your anger. And so in some ways, if you want a word picture, you push down all your anger and create this molten lava deep inside of a volcano. But you can't let that anger out because it'll only lead to more pain. And so many stuff it down so far that they're not even aware that it's there. Now some, they find ways to express that anger, to let it out, not at mom and dad, but maybe at kids at school, at their siblings, at animals. They might do things that are vandalism. They might light fires. That's what happens with angry children. It has to come out for some of them. But here's another part that I want you to understand about complex trauma and anger. Do you see that the healthy design of anger is that when love is violated, you get angry, and the pull of anger is let's get back to love. Let's get back to healthy. Anger has a powerful pull on you to get back to angry. To get back to healthy. What happens though in the child where you can't ever resolve anything, where nothing ever gets back to healthy? Anger begins to have the reverse pull. It begins to pull you in a negative direction, not in a positive direction. And so now when you're angry, what do you want to do? Hurt somebody. Isolate. Hurt yourself. Shut down. So anger then has just as much power, but it's pulling you now to a self-destructive, to a relationship-destructive place. That's, to me, part of the tragedy of complex trauma. So sadly, what happens in that child is there's all this lava underneath the surface constantly, because every day new things that violate love take place that they got to stuff down. And so anger becomes their default setting. They're just angry all the time. Sometimes not even aware of it, but it is there. Others, they actually, when they start to lash out and they get a bit older and they can start to express their anger, they like that feeling of cortisol. And so they get addicted to that anger. And so that can become a big issue for them. But for many, there's an element of that anger that always is turned inward. The shame part of it. It's my fault. I'm bad. I must be doing something wrong. Nobody loves me because I'm not good enough. And so the anger gets...
Egameno joma uyerere koko marungura, kalishia shike upsa kathi wapau teknika, oliriwa omkundu wapashigwana upsa kathi wapaliko, no hashivuro oku ya moshipara uhupiro uongeshefa. Washini momtumba ogo Namibia International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition omvomao vigajo miongo mbalina hamano. Iikondo epangero mahangano wapau mwene, uministeri wepangero ni ikondo ya yoroka no handimwe, onetamu ithanwa muhoroke komtumba omtitatu watumburu wa mete. Tekero. Esi kwa milongo mbali naga alisi kwa mbali naga nega apiriri maovigali milongo mbali naga mano ekara uko Arembush Travel Lodge movenduka. Oshi parashi kundathanwa okuanja gane kuyerele kombinga uko shoki wapa ungomba ano cyber hygiene. Kene una oku ironge kithira o mashongo uko marungura no marongo kekopopeko jerongitho jo marungura na ilwe inji koneka o mahangano o handimwe ni kondo mboka tamukatu ma a kaliripo ya konda pantu ya tano o tamukape wa ompi pito yom tugumwe awedu apo hasho ashikeshoka pethimbo yom tumba ogo tungoka otakukakara o VIP cyber gala dina nuyere lounji wa maisha angitho no mapura apuro kwatatha na nayo konoraje tatu imwe o ndatu ya tano o mgo igeali nenge ko email info@dstech.com.na nenge utarele pwe panja jao jopa ungomba ko www.dstech.com.na. Namibia International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition Securing Namibia Digital Future.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh?
Turned on themselves, and then every time they perceive that they fail, they got to beat themselves up. And so there's a strong inner critic inside of them. Some even self-harm, but it's anger turned on itself. And that becomes a reality of so many people. So let me ask you some general questions just about your life and your upbringing. So on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being basically nothing, to 10 being explosive, what was the amount of anger in your family? Now, you got to be careful here, because a lot of people say, well, my family never got angry. And I go, okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm not talking about how it got explosive anger expression. I'm talking about what did you sense as a child about how angry people were. Rate that on a scale of 1 to 10. And that often is surprising for people. Second one, scale of 1 to 10. Rate the amount of anger in your life in the last 10 years. Third one, scale of 1 to 10. Rate the amount of anger in your life over the last 2 months. And then look at your latest anger experience. What triggered it? Scale of 1 to 10, how intense was it? So those are just some questions that hopefully are helpful. So let's go back to this volcano. So again, people from complex trauma have a huge ocean of lava at the base of that volcano. It's been there for years. It's been added to, but it's there. And it's always simmering below the surface. once in a while, something will trigger that anger in a special way, and there will be an eruption, an anger event. So there's two types of anger. That's what I want you to see. There's the lava anger that's always there. There's the explosion, eruption anger. Now, again, some people often aren't convinced that they have anger issues, because in their mind, when they think of anger events, they only think of huge, violent eruptions, somebody yelling, screaming, throwing stuff. Then you go, there's an angry person, and it's obvious. And that's their whole definition of an angry person, is they have explosion-type anger. And that definitely is an anger type. But you realize there's three other ways that people express anger. And these might be your ways. Because these other three, they don't even look like they have an anger issue. They don't even look like there's any anger issues at all. So number one is, like we say, we stuff it. We stuff it so well and so good, as soon as we feel anger down, we're cool. Meanwhile, we have high blood pressure, can't sleep well, irritable a lot, but we don't have anger issues. So that's the stuffer. Secondly, the turning it on ourselves. So the person who is constantly tearing themselves down in their mind, constantly criticizing themselves, finding fault with themselves, beating themselves up, even hurting themselves. It's like, I need to be punished, so I am going to do that to myself. I'm going to be judge and executioner. And so a lot of people struggle with that. But then the next one is underhanded, and it's an important one to understand. Some people would refer to it as passive aggressive. So this is the sneaky kind of anger, where you're angry, but you don't look like you're angry. You're subtle in how you express it. So just example, a sarcastic person. Oh yeah, they say, you can't do anything right. And you go, now, do they mean that? Or, because it feels like there's an edge to it. And you go, do you mean that? No, I'm just joking. So you take a shot, but you say it vaguely enough with humor that you can never be pinned down that you're taking a shot. But you hope they got it. So that's one. Some of you have gone through living with a mom or a spouse who, silent treatment. They're punishing you by not talking to you. You try to connect to them, but you just hit this cold, silent wall. And they're not going to talk to you until they're sure they've punished you enough. But if you were to say, are you mad at me? No. Deny it. Because you're not expressing anger, you're just quiet. So that's a underhanded, sneaky, passive-aggressive. Some, they just pout and give you one-word answers. How are you doing today? Fine. You don't sound fine. Are you sure you're okay? Yep. You want to talk about anything? Nope. Okay. Same idea. Others, once you've been married for a while, you get to know what annoys your spouse. And so you're annoyed at them, but you're not going to show it, so you just push their buttons all day. You do things that you know are going to irritate them and get them angry. And then when they get angry at you, you go, whoa, you got an anger issue. You need to look at that. Meanwhile, you're the one with the anger issue. You're just super sneaky about it. So for a lot of people, they can do all four of these anger styles. So they might start by stuffing it, turning it on themselves. Then they might get a little underhanded, And then it's still building and finally they explode. Others, they just find a favorite style and get really good at it. And that's just their major go-to whenever they feel angry. But again, I want you to see is that 3/4 of these, there's anger issues there, but you don't see them. They're hidden. They're sneaky. But it's still anger that is driving it. Now I got to take another step here with complex trauma. So complex trauma, the child begins with healthy anger, but that doesn't lead to anything being resolved. Rather, it leads to them being punished, so they stuff it. But then they learn by watching mom and dad get angry all the time, and it has some positive purposes. So they begin to learn over time unhealthy uses of anger that are self-serving. So let me give them to you. If I get angry, I intimidate people. And that allows me to maintain control over people. So it's a great tool in being a control freak type person. Others, if I'm angry, then all of a sudden I'm not feeling my sadness or my anxiety. So anger medicates other painful emotions. So as soon as I'm feeling embarrassment or shame or fear, turn it into anger and then only feel anger and I won't feel that other stuff. Or how do I keep people from getting in my space? I don't know how to set healthy boundaries. I don't know how to say no or please give me space. I'm afraid they won't like me with that. So what's the only way to set a boundary that they have? Either isolate or explode in anger. And when you explode in anger, you drive everybody away because they're afraid of you. The problem with that is it seems to work. It gives you some space. But then typically people feel guilty for driving everybody away with their anger explosion. And so then they just let everybody back in and become a doormat to them until they're so smothered again, they got to explode again. And it starts this kind of yo-yo effect, which is not healthy at all. And then others learn, if I'm angry at somebody, it's a great way to hurt people, to pay them back. It's a great way of revenge. And then for others, when I'm angry, I got that cortisol happening, and that gives me energy. And so I like anger because it gives me energy to do my chores. It gives me energy to get my jobs done. So anger becomes my fuel. Or, when I'm angry, I'm more on guard. There's an edge to me where I'm not letting anybody too close. I'm checking everybody out. So anger keeps me safe, is what happens. Then, every time I'm angry, it's in my brain, never my fault. It's always somebody else's fault. So anger allows me to blame everybody else. And I feel self-righteous. I feel I'm better than everybody else. That's a positive part to anger. And then some go, I don't ever want to resolve an anger when somebody hurts me. Because if I resolve that anger, I might drop my guard and they might hurt me again. So I need to turn that anger into a resentment so that I never drop my guard with that person again and I'll never get hurt. Many people, when it comes to setting boundaries, they don't know how to set a healthy boundary unless they close their heart to the person. That's their only way of being able to enforce a boundary. And so to close their heart to their person, they got to be angry at that person. So anger plays a role there. I've worked with many people that have been that intimidating, angry person as an adult for years, and that got them respect. It wasn't a respect from people that they admired you. It was a respect that they feared you. And they go, well, it's still respect. So their anger, their intimidating presence became their identity. And I've actually had clients say to me, I'm afraid to give up my anger because I'm afraid I won't know who I am. And I don't know if I'll like that person. Next thing, when I'm angry, I'm blaming everybody else. I never have to self-examine very much. I avoid looking too closely at myself. And then when I'm angry, I don't want anybody. I don't need anybody. It makes me feel very independent. And it's my way of convincing myself I don't need anybody. And then the final one. For some people, in their family growing up, the only way anybody got listened to is not when they talked quietly. The only time you got noticed and paid attention to is when you were yelling. And so anger became necessary to be heard, to be taken seriously. And so that still is part of their thinking. Okay, so that's not looking like a pretty picture. Anger is becoming this very much a weapon and a shield for people that is all unhealthy tools. So what are some of the issues that come out of that if you don't deal with it? Well, for many people, especially those coming out of addiction, every time their anger is triggered, they go to their limbic brain. And what does their limbic brain want to do? Something impulsive. And so a lot of people with addiction issues is, I'm angry, I'm going to go and punish you by relapsing. So it's a huge relapse issue. For many that I deal with, what they realize is they get to understand their anger and become aware of all of this lava that they push down, is they go, I think I've been as angry as long as I can remember. I'm just not sure why. And I'm kind of afraid of looking at my anger. I'm afraid of actually letting some anger out. Because I'm afraid if I let a bit of anger out, it's going to come out scary and do a ton of damage. I am afraid of my anger. That's so common. But then for many people, they have so much guilt around their anger. Every time it has come out, it's done a ton of damage to their children, to their partner. They can be a wonderful person 99% of the time, but that 1%, when they get angry, man, the damage it does and the guilt they feel. But then when they begin to understand anger, they go, when my anger gets triggered, I go from 0 to 100 in a nanosecond. And what you're telling me to do is I need to, in that nanosecond, stop my anger, which is being fueled by cortisol, and to choose a different set of tools to respond in that nanosecond. This is going to be hard. And I go, yeah, this is going to be super hard. And then they go, okay, if I only got triggered by one or two things, then maybe this would be okay. But I get triggered by hundreds of different things. I get anger triggered multiple times every day. It's a constant thing I have to deal with. And so they begin to realize, yeah, this is going to be difficult. Let me go back to anger being scary. I have a lot of clients that talk to me about a black rage. And so they get so angry that they all go to a place where they don't even remember what happens next. It's just like they black out and this rage takes over. So that is a scary thing for people. And then, because it pulls in such a powerful way and in a negative direction, if you don't deal with it, it's going to keep taking you to negative places. That's what I want you to see. Anger no longer pulls you, as it should, in a positive direction, only negative. And so you have to stop that and retrain it to pull you in a positive direction again. But if you don't do the work, it'll keep pulling you to a darker, darker place where more and more damage is done. Now I find that, like I said, some get addicted to being angry. Some wake up angry. They're already angry and they go looking for an excuse to justify that anger. They go looking for something that they can say, oh, that makes me angry, and then they can lash out. And so their whole day becomes finding ways to vent their anger, even if they got to make it up. Another issue that comes out of not dealing with your anger is when your anger is triggered and you're in your limbic brain, it is really hard to stick to healthy boundaries, healthy filters. So you might say to your spouse, I'm committing myself to the healthy boundary of always being respectful in my speech to you. What happens when you get angry? Whoa, that boundary? Who cares? I want to say this to you. All the filters disappear and you forget about that respect boundary. And so anger gets you to your limbic brain and it gets you to overstep healthy boundaries in relationships. And it makes you feel better in the moment, but wow, does it make you feel terrible afterwards. And then just like I said already, healthy anger is still very possible and is important to allow it in my life and to learn when it's healthy, but then when it crosses a line and becomes unhealthy. That's part of what the journey is. And so for many people, they have healthy anger today, and then they need to learn, what do I need to do about to fix this situation, to get back to love, and then I can let it go. And then it's resolved. But for some, the healthy anger stage is past, but they still want to hang on to the anger and turn it into a resentment. And then it goes into unhealthy. And that does a ton of damage. Gabor Mate, who we talk about all the time, has written a book called The Cost of Hidden Stress, When the Body Says No. And what he says is when we have been prevented from learning how to say no, our bodies may end up saying it for us. So his thesis is that repressed anger and stress, both which have cortisol, you push that down, it will result in significant health problems. So they now have evidence that it takes people to Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, MS, multiple sclerosis, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's, fibromyalgia, and IBS. 40% of cancer patients have experienced the death of a parent before the age of 19. So repression, he says it this way, dissociating emotions from awareness, relegating them to the unconscious realm, and the result is it disorganizes and confuses our psychological defenses so that in some people, these defenses go awry, becoming the destroyers of health rather than the protectors. So another way to say that, When we repress our emotions, particularly anger, they now operate in the subconscious and they put a ton of stress on our bodies that does a ton of damage. So let me come to tools for dealing with anger. We got to deal with the lava and we got to deal with the eruptions. Most anger management courses just focus on dealing with the eruptions. And what I say is that doesn't work for people with complex trauma. If they don't have tools to deal with the lava, you can give them tools to deal with the eruptions all day long, and they're eventually not going to work because the lava is going to keep boiling out. So they need to start with tools to deal with the lava. And that is going back, finding the wound that caused the anger, being able to heal that wound and resolve it. Very slowly beginning to be aware of what's caused the lava, healing the lava, reducing that total amount of lava. That is a long journey. It's slow self-awareness. But every time your anger gets triggered, don't just focus on the here and now eruption. Go back to what got triggered. What old wound is there that wasn't responded to as a child, that violated love, that I need to begin to find healing for? So that's part one. So I hope you see that there's not a magic solution to this. This is a lot of hard work. We've done a whole series on this. It's on YouTube. It gives lots of practical tools, and I don't have the time to go through all of them. I just want to give you three things to be aware of that hopefully will help you as a starting point in beginning to deal with the anger, with the eruption stuff, and with the lava. So with the eruption stuff, because that's when the most of the damage gets done. In the heat of the moment, here's the big picture. In the heat of the moment, 0 to 100 nanosecond, you're being asked to respond differently in that nanosecond, to go in a different direction with different tools when you've got one of the most powerful forces in the world pulling you to where you always gone in the past. So this is not going to be easy. You will probably not succeed the first time, the second time, the third time. But each time you might fail, but learn from the failure. So that next time when you get triggered, in that nanosecond, you have a new tool that you can use that will help. And slowly you begin to acquire tools where you start to respond differently to the nanosecond. Somebody said this, anger, if not restrained, is frequently more hurtful to us than the injury that provokes it. So you start by biting your tongue, and that's really hard to do, especially in that nanosecond. Now, that's not pushing it down. That's just saying, oops, I'm in my limbic brain. I need to not react right now because I'll say something I regret. I need to be able to de-escalate and get back to my cortex and resolve it. So the goal is still resolution, is just realizing there's a timeline now, and right now I gotta bite my tongue. So then we do the grounding, the de-escalating. So for some people, grounding, I gotta get by myself and I gotta do some breathing. Deep breathing, that helps calm me down, get me out of my limbic brain. Some people find grounding helpful to bring into, okay, what are my five senses picking up right now? That puts me back in the present. That puts me back to feeling. And that is very grounding. Others like to just review facts. What are all the hockey teams of the NHL? What are all the capital cities? And just getting into their cortex thinking about something else helps to ground them. Others like a visualization, like a remote control where I'm turning down the volume, or a stove with a bunch of elements and one's red hot and the pot's boiling, but I take it off it and put it on a back burner where it's going to be cooling down. All of those are helpful. Second thing, sometimes you just got to get out of the situation and go for a walk. If you stay in the situation, you just keep getting triggered, and you can't control it. You need to take a break. Some, when they take a break, they need time to process alone before they come back to try to resolve it. So they need to write some stuff down. So journaling, point form, whatever, but just to help them begin to process it. And writing focuses the mind and helps slow it down. Others, they need to talk to somebody who's objective, who can help them see it from different perspectives. That has a very grounding effect on them. So, grounding, de-escalate, so important. Toughest tools to learn because of the cortisol anger fuel, but some of the most important to learn if you're going to do well in recovery. Second thing that I would say, and this is mindfulness, and that's becoming aware of your anger patterns. So you can see in the diagram, there's a trigger, something triggers you, triggers your anger, and then that affects four different things. It affects you physically. You have physical symptoms when you're angry. It affects how you think. It affects other emotions, and it affects your actions. I'm not going to go into that. They're in another series if you want to watch it. But become aware of your anger patterns. So let me just give you the triggers thing to think about. Most of us have hundreds of things that trigger anger. It can be what a person says or does. It can be an event. But again, it's touching an old wound.
And we don't want to touch those old wounds. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have officially come to the end of our lecture this evening. I thought I would just let you know that we need to learn. And I'm here for it. I'm here for it. And we are going through these motions of life together. And it is what it is. So from me, the matriarch, I bid you guys farewell. I'll see you again tomorrow, Chomi. And we will continue. Aluta, continua, Victoria, forever.